ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Craig
and Matt
Allen.
And a welcome back with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP and at Matt Allen FNP. A week away, no big UFC cards. Of course, KSW featured Marius Pudzianowski just absolutely obliterating a man, a former middleweight champ over there in Mazurla. But we're really parlaying everything forward and looking at this big time card that's absolutely loaded. 14 fights on deck, 5 debuts, 4 ranked fighters, and a big time heavyweight tilt at the top between Alexander Volkov and Jairzinho Rozenstruik. Matt, I know this is one of those cards that some fights might go under the radar, but there's something here for every single MMA fan this weekend.
Just like what probably would have been a fight of the night in 2015 between Felice Herrig and Karolina Kovalkiewicz, this is an interesting card because, like you said, there are a number of debuts to be made on this card, but there is also the return of some older fighters that we haven't seen in a meaningful period of time. So I do think this card has a good blend of both, and it should make for an exciting fight.
It should be an exciting one. We're going to throw it on over to, as always, at the start of the Fight Night Pick shows, the Fight of the Night screen. And listen, 14 fights, it's hard to narrow it down to just 2. So let us know down below in that comment section who you have in your possible Fight of the Night. We'll throw it on over to that Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
Dan Ige has gone through a couple of different nicknames at this point, and 50K is the one that he's hoping to stick with, and he's hoping to stick Movsar Evloev with one of those Gavin Tucker shots that he was able to land. He looked amazing in that fight, and for Ige, he's had some main event slots in the past. He gets a big-time opportunity, but this feels like less of an opportunity for Ige, where he gets to stick around in the upper conversation of the featherweight division, but more of a springboard for Movsar Evloev. And we threw this one out there to the YouTube community tab. We'll be talking about that and your votes and, of course, your comments over there once we get to that full-length prediction in this video. But this is a fight of the night. I mean, I think it's absolute fireworks.
And it's going to prove a lot about Movsar Evloev because he's looked so good against some guys who are definitely not on Dan Ige's level. And the great thing about Ige is that, okay, he might not be seen as the elite of the elite in this division, but we know how well he stacks up against the elite in this division. So let's say Movsar is able to look really good against Dan Ige. Like, Ige's gone to a decision with guys like Calvin Cater or Korean Zombie. Let's say Evloev is somehow able to finish him in a 3-round fight. Imagine what that's going to do for Movsar Evloev's stock in the whole grand scheme of things. Like, this is probably the most important fight on the card, even though it is only the co-main event.
Dan Ige has a win over Edson Barboza. Yes, that really happened. So this should be a great fight. Hey, outside the box thinking. I mean, listen, you have a debuting fighter that no longer looks like the man on the other side of the screen, and Askar Mazharov, no mercy. He's taking on Atomic Alonzo Menifield. Why do I say that Mazharov no longer looks like that? Well, go look at his recent fights. He is a behemoth of a man now. It's like if Matt and I took the Steve Rogers special serum and became Captain America, well, that's what Askar Mazharov did, and he added some tattoos in the process.
I wish we could figure out whatever Vitor was on between like 2012 and 14, get us both on it, because we would probably take a similar transformation. It is kind of wild. He's done the opposite of Jared Cannonier pretty much, and I think this is going to be a great debut for him, because in Alonzo Menifield, again, he's not one of these fighters that we look at as one of the elites in the division, but he has been able to fight quite a few top tier fighters in the 205 pound division, so I do think this fight is going to be a very fun one.
Should be a fun one, and Alonzo Menifield, the forever prospect at 34 years of age. I think this one's going to be fun as long as it lasts, but you let us know down below, like I said, in that comment section, who you have in a possible fight of the night. 14 to choose from. Let us know down there. Big time show coming up. So we started off the hop, and of course, if people couldn't tell already, I'm at the tail end of a cold, so I'm going to sound fun for this show. I mean, really, I could hit some of those high notes. I could sound like Lane Staley with Alice in Chains. Would. But we have a big time card coming up. I mean, Matt, we talked about it. 4 ranked fighters, the 2 fighters in the main event, the 2 fighters in the co-main event, the debuts of Karin, and it's the most aggressive nickname you've ever heard, Killer Silva. She's going to be taking on Pauliana Botelho. You've got Askar Mazharov, who's going to be taking on the aforementioned Alonzo Menifield. We also have Rinat Fakhretdinov. He's going to be taking on Andreas Mihailidis at 170 pounds, so that is an oddball fight in and of itself. You also have Lucas Almeida, the former Jungle Fights champ, at 155 pounds, dropping down to take on Mike Trezano, former Ultimate Fighter winner, that one at featherweight. And we also have the short notice debut of the determined Dan Argueta. He's going to be taking on Damon Jackson on about a week's notice. He's the former LFA bantamweight champ. He just won that belt in the past month. So a big opportunity for the determined Dan Argueta, training partner of Cub Swanson, but he also trains at Jackson Wink. I think this, again, is one of those cards that has everything. And if people weren't already excited about it, Karolina Kovalkiewicz's last win was over Felice Herrig. They're rematching that fight. Matt, how could you not be popcorn in hand, like standing off of your couch getting excited about that one?
In a fight that you haven't even mentioned yet, Jeff Molina, Zhalgash Umagulov is buried on the prelims, and I don't really know why. Because Jeff Molina hasn't gotten the Sean O'Malley promotional push, but I do feel like he's one of these fighters who isn't ranked, but he's known much more than just your average unranked fighter. He speaks very well, he has a very fun fighting style, and if he's able to beat Umagulov, who, like, he's been in there with some really good fighters himself, so if Jeff Molina is able to get a really big win this weekend, I do expect him to get a much bigger push from the organization.
The people will point to Umagulov's, the names, rather, that are on Umagulov's resume, and I'll do that too, so you're not going to want to miss that, and the rest of the previews and predictions here, make sure you toss a sub and a like for the boys as we move forward, because this is a big-time card, and of course, 2 hours before the prelims with question mark kicks, so keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. And coming up this weekend, flyweight's knocking on the top 15 of the division, and a great opportunity on a couple of tidy little win streaks. We have cold-blooded Aaron Blanchfield taking on JJ Aldrich of No Fix Nickname. And when it comes to this fight,
it should be been there, done that, but I don't think that's going to catch on.
I mean, JJ Aldrich, she's been around. She's been around since the Ultimate Fighter way back when, and I'll talk about that a lot more as we move forward. But for Aaron Blanchfield, I think the focus this week is definitely on her. She's a prospect that's on everybody's radar, and of course, it was echoed by the broadcast, but it was a talking point for us going into Aaron Blanchfield's last fight, which took on Miranda Maverick. At the very end of the fight, Daniel Cormier said, hey, JA, you and me, we had Miranda Maverick as like that next champ, and now all of a sudden Blanchfield's able to get the win. She steals that thunder. And the craziest part about Blanchfield's last fight being against Miranda Maverick was that it was originally supposed to be Macy Barber. So ultimately, you're beating the prospect who was supposed to beat the other prospect, but didn't beat that prospect. It's a great opportunity. And when I look at both of these fighters, and of course, for Blanchfield, only one loss as a pro. It's a split decision against Tracy Cortez. When Blanchfield was only 19 years old and Tracy was 6 years her senior, in that one, very, very close. But for Blanchfield, Matt, going from an 18-year-old Eddie Bravo Invitational grappling winner to the point that she's at right now, her wrestling and her grappling are so on point. She represents Henzo Gracie's out of New York, but cross-trains at a multitude of different gyms. We've seen a big evolution in the fact that she can just impose her will on these women and take them down again and again and again and hold great positions. She's such a good position over submission type of fighter, or position over, I'm going to put my knee on belly, go for that ground attack for the ground and pound. She's so sound when it comes to her groundwork, that posing a big problem for JJ Aldrich. Well, we really haven't seen anybody work their ground game on Aldrich, with the exception of Juliana Lima in the UFC. That's the only fighter that was able to take her down again and again and again. Other than that, 4 takedowns that Lima was able to get against Aldrich, everybody else has only been able to get one here or there. So,
but when they do get the one, they do make a lot of use of it. And that's the thing about JJ Aldrich. I'm going to sag a little bit. You can hold her down. Her initial takedown defense is good. She has really good boxing. And she is really good with her range management. That's the thing about JJ Aldrich. If she does get into her boxing range, she can really make you pay for just putting your hands down and going for takedown attempts. And that's why a lot of fighters who do fight her, they will try to wrestle her early on, but she can hurt them early. Maybe not hurt them, but at least damage them to the point to where they won't just rush in for their takedown attempts. With Blanchfield, though, she's so physically strong for this weight division. It's really one of the biggest things that does stand out. She didn't just out-grapple Miranda Maverick. She, like, big brothered her. Like, it was like the Bear and the Revenant going after Leonardo DiCaprio. She was all over Maverick at all times throughout that fight, and I really thought Maverick was going to have a lot more success on her feet, being able to move in and out of range, but just the forward pressure up Blanchfield does eventually seem to get to her opponents. And with JJ Aldrich, it's kind of weird because she is very... I don't want to use one-dimensional in a negative way, but she is a one-dimensional fighter. She will use her boxing. She's not big on her kicks. She'll go for her own offensive takedowns. But that's the thing about Aldridge. She's one of these fighters who, offensively with her takedowns, she's not that bad. I do worry about her defensively grappling against someone like Blanchfield, though, who, yes, she won't go for the submission right away like she's Charles Oliveira, but if Blanchfield can get on top in that first round, okay, bank that round, don't do anything too crazy. I don't know if Aldridge's gonna have enough pop on her shots in that second and third round to really go out there and get a TKO or at least win a round decisively enough to where someone would give her a 10-8, because for Aldridge, that really has been her Achilles heel. Not a great finisher at any one area in the UFC. She really does rely on the fact that she's gonna go out there, try to win by decision, use a lot of her volume and output, but the problem is, if she's not winning these rounds by like 20, 30 significant strikes, I really do think one takedown from Blanchfield with a lot of control time is going to negate whatever progress Aldridge is able to get.
And that's the weird thing. For JJ Aldridge, you look at the record, she has a loss to Sabina Mazo about 2.5 years ago, and then she took a year and a few months off and really retooled herself. And then we see her come out and fight Courtney Casey, wins that fight by split decision. MMA decisions, 15-1 in terms of scoring for Casey in that fight. The 29-28s had it, but she has been able to parlay that into a nice little run. She beats Vanessa Demopoulos. She beats Jillian Robertson. 6 judges' scorecards of 30-27 split between those fights. And really, it's been the JJ Aldridge show out of those two showings. Now, we talk about it a lot on the channel. Her boxing is her strongest suit. But it's kind of odd. She's a third degree black belt in Taekwondo and she never throws kicks.
At all. And it's not even like she moves like someone who does Taekwondo. Because there are some fighters who, like Wonderboy, for instance, is kind of boxing heavy at this stage. He throws a lot of punches. But at least he has the movement with his feet of someone who does have that background. But I think that is a good point. Aldridge is very stationary with her advancement in the cage. And I do think that's going to be a problem. Like, every time Aldridge plants her feet to throw a big shot, she's going to leave herself wide open for a takedown from Aaron Blanchfield. And Blanchfield might even be able to get a stoppage in this fight just because Aldridge doesn't have that one-punch power. She doesn't even really have submission ability off of her back especially. So I just don't know what Aldridge can do to go out there and bank like 4 minutes of a round. Because again, I just think if Blanchfield's able to get that one takedown, it's really going to be able to reverse whatever damage, or at least make up for whatever damage JJ Aldridge was able to get in the early goings of that round. But the thing I will say, I do think Aldridge has better cardio than Blanchfield. I don't know this for a fact, but in Blanchfield's fights, for the most part, it's all going her way. It's just a lot of grappling. I'm always the one dictating the dance. I'm the one dictating the pace. The good thing about Aldridge is that she can throw a pretty good volume. She can move around on her feet quite a bit for a 15-minute fight. So I'm not going to say she's going to go out there and out-cardio Aaron Blanchfield, but I'm curious to see what this fight looks like in the third round because I do like Aldridge as this fight goes later.
Yeah, and I mean, for Aldridge, trains out of Elevation, Eaton Training Center, Elevation with fighters like Tisha Torres, Rocky Pennington, but not the one out of the Amber Heard trial. She doesn't want to be mistaken for that one. Who else? Rose Namajunas. Oh, yeah. And Miranda Maverick. So maybe a little bit of a game plan there, even though Maverick had no success. And for Blanchfield, you look at just the two fights in the UFC against Sarah Alper, who dropped down from bantamweight to flyweight. 198-45, the total strikes. 30-25, 30-25, 30-26.
It was dominant.
9 minutes and 43 seconds of control time against Miranda Maverick. 7 of 8 on takedowns. 12 minutes of control time. For Aldridge, one big positive out of her last fight. I know I accentuated her last two fights because she was able to stick and move on the outside and defend the takedowns of Demopoulos
against
and Robertson.
Who, though?
And Robertson, but 10 of 11 takedowns were defended by Aldridge her last time out. So again, for the odds in this fight, Blanchfield opened a minus 275, minus 579 right now. For Aldridge, open a plus 235, plus 403. We'll have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. This is becoming a meme on Twitter. Surprise to us, it is to you. I'm going to say over under 80% Blanchfield.
I think over.
You thinking it's over? It is over. 1,303 total votes, 90% Blanchfield, 88% by decision for the 10% that have Aldridge, 76% by decision. I'm surprised more don't have it by decision for Aldridge. I have Aaron Blanchfield in this fight. I think she's going to be able to take down once again. She was able to do it against a teammate being Miranda Maverick to JJ Aldridge. I think she's going to have a fairly easy time in this one. And considering that Jessica Andrade is ranked at both strawweight and flyweight, if you dissolve that ranking out of there at flyweight, I'd say either one of these two women probably already has that 15. So I would expect the winner of this fight to be ranked next week.
not to pump my own tires, but I've said this for a long time. I've thought Erin Blanchfield is what John Anik thought Miranda Maverick was going to be for a long time now. She does have that one area of her game that is so dominant, unless you do have some sort of a reversal to it, you're not going to really have much of an answer. And for Aldridge, fighting Vanessa Demopoulos and Jillian Robertson, those fighters are kind of similar to Erin Blanchfield, to where they're going to go for the takedown, they are going to try to use their grappling, but they are nowhere near the level of grappler Erin Blanchfield is once she's able to get on top of her opponent. She's really going to be able to sap the energy from JJ Aldridge, and I don't expect this to be very competitive once Blanchfield gets this to the mat. Now, Aldridge is the better boxer, she is the better striker, I could see her having some early success. I just think it's a matter of time before Blanchfield gets close and gets this fight to the mat.
Big time opportunity for JJ Aldridge. Blanchfield likes to stand and block with her arms sometimes, so a good opportunity for Aldridge to try and land some volume in this fight, but both of us going with cold-blooded, like a what? Like a Gila monster. Cold-blooded like, Erin Blanchfield. Great opportunity for her to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight. And for the rest of them, it's a big-time card, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
So for Fight Night Picks fans, you folks are going to enjoy this, because coming up this weekend, we have Greece's Andreas Mihailidis taking on, finally, the debuting Rinat Fakhretdinov. I know so many people are excited about the guy on the right-hand side of the screen. That's not Matt Allen. It's the man with the AKA Thailand muscle shirt.
I don't think we could look any different.
In Fakhretdinov. But when it comes to this fight, I'm going to talk a little bit about Andreas Mihailidis. So save your excitement for just a second. Because for Mihailidis, the promotion let him hit off a tee one time, then he went up 3-0 against Dylan Cease, and he struck out. And then if you really focus on it, coming up this weekend, it's like, okay, well, you struck out your last time, here's Shane McClanahan, go try and get a hit off of him. It's not gonna happen. So for you non-baseball fans, what I'm saying is, for Mihailidis, his last time out, he was up 3-0. He was able to win a convincing round against Alex Pereira. He looked really good with his takedowns in that first round. Comes out in the second round, you're already up 3-0. You're going to get a fastball. And he gets a flying knee to the dome, and he gets knocked out. So coming up this weekend, it's like, okay, we're going to give Andreas another shot against a really hyped prospect, like trying to hit off McClanahan. McClanahan and Cease, two of the biggest strikeout artists in the game right now. And when it comes to Rinat Fakhretdinov, the guy's 20-2, but Matt, all the chatter I see about the card coming up this weekend, no word of lies about Fakhretdinov and how excited fans are about his style.
I'm pretty excited about his style, but I gotta be honest, I haven't seen as much hype. I'm excited, though, that a guy making his UFC debut is getting a lot of notoriety coming in, and this is a fairly favorable stylistic matchup for him, if we are being honest, because if you know anything about Rinat Fakhretdinov, I think I said that right, it's that, I don't know if you remember our boy Eric Spicely, and I say our boy just because he's Canadian, but he had a bit of a run in the UFC.
American, but he trained in TriStar.
He beat Thiago Santos. That's a wild thing to say, but he did. He submitted a very, very naked choke. Here's the thing. Gets cut by the UFC. Signs a deal with UAE Warriors. Puts out a tweet. Hey, guys, I've got a fight coming up soon. You should check it out. And that's what I did. I was going to check out Eric Spicely's up-and-coming fight. It didn't go well for him at all. And with Rinat, he almost throws punches in that, like, Daniel Cormier, Volkan Oezdemir kind of way, where he will get the arm-flailing tube man going every now and then, where it will be very looping hook-esque, and it will leave wide openings, and that's what I really do worry about in this fight against Mihailidis, who, it is weird, if you just look at Mihailidis' run in the UFC, then yes, you were probably not impressed by him whatsoever, but even look at these small amounts of success that he has had in isolated moments throughout his fights. Like you said, he looked pretty good early on against Alex Pereira, a guy who we all know and quite a few people do love. He's going to be fighting Sean Strickland soon in a main event that has major title implications moving forward.
One guy's allowed on Twitter.
That's true, and the other guy is not. But for Mihailidis, he does have that back pocket, or he does have that takedown in his back pocket. It would just be nice to see him actually mix in his striking with his takedown a little bit more, instead of being all one or all the other, because he does have pretty good movement on the feet. It's something I do like out of his style, but the problem is, he doesn't have that in-between. I know this is something we talk about for fighters all the time, like Gilbert Burns was the poster boy for, hey, he's pretty good at all these singular areas if he can only bring it together. With Mihailidis, he doesn't have any one background that is like Gilbert Burns jiu-jitsu that he can fall on, but he does have very good singular skills that if he could actually get them all together, then I think we could see maybe not a title run out of him, but we could see a 3-4 fight win streak out of him in the UFC.
Red Rover, send Craig over. So for Mihailidis, he is a 2010 European BJJ champion. He does have that 3-time kickboxing champion. But you're right. He lacks every single in-between.
Which, like, is odd.
When it comes to his striking, it's flashy. There's a lot of wasted movement. But when it's good, it's really good. Like the Marcel Fortuna fights, the one that I think of. Like, really flashy spin kicks. And when it comes down to this fight, I know, again, folks are all about Rinat Fakhretdinov. This guy's the wonkiest striker I've ever seen. And again, this fight, and I can't stress this enough. You can see the two weights up there. Middleweight. But if you go over to Tapology, UFC stats, the UFC press release, dropping down to welterweight, this fight's at welterweight. I don't know what either guy is going to look like on the scale. This is so sketchy. And again, Fakhretdinov's a guy that will plant and throw, but then after he's thrown his one club, he'll continue to throw 3 or 4 more punches. It's so sloppy, his striking. And again, former GFC champ is Fakhretdinov, but he relinquished the belt because he didn't want to fight his Muslim brothers, and I respect that. I mean, listen, stick to your convictions and your morals. Like, that's pretty cool. So for Fakhretdinov, GFC champ, the Khabib promotion that was, he took a lot of time off. He fights Eric Spicely, knocks him out in front of Dana White. Just on Dana White's stuff. Looking for a fight before looking for FWD to a fight. Before, who was it, Diego Sanchez and his coach, before it got really weird. But Fakhretdinov gets a big win. Dana's talking about signing him. And now, a year and a half later, we're here. He's fighting Andreas Mihailidis. But again, UFC stats have Fakhretdinov's record is 18-1. Other sources, 20-2. So it's sketchy. And also, level competition, very bad.
It is very poor. But again, we do have to say something that we often say. He beat the guys in the way that you do want him to beat them for the most part. He does have a ton of stoppages on his record via submission and via knockout. Against, you are right, he hasn't been tested a lot, but it does have to be said, he has looked really good in those fights. It's not like he was having close fights with guys that were like 1-2 and then destroying guys that were 0-5, you know? So for Fakhretdinov, I think he does have a big X factor in this fight. And I do agree with everything you said. He is wild. He does strike in a straight line. Mihailidis defends in a straight line a lot of the times. He does have good left-to-right movement, but when he gets blitzed, when he gets pressured, he will just go straight backwards. And sometimes it'll be, I get my back to the cage, then I'll try to shoot a takedown. Sometimes it'll be, I get my back to the cage, and I try to strike. But the common factor in all of this is that Mihailidis can get backed up in his fights if he's not doing something offensive. So if Fakhretdinov is able to, maybe not even stun him, just land one good strike, decide to follow up with a blitz. If Mihailidis doesn't exit on an angle and Fakhretdinov just follows him with his feet, all of those strikes are going to continue to land. And it will be interesting to see what cardio of both these guys is going to be as this fight goes on, because I think they're going to fight at a pretty crazy pace early on. I really do. And I don't expect either guy's style to really tend towards longevity in this fight. So I will be very curious to see what does Mihailidis look like in the third round if he is defending a lot of these flurries and if he's not really able to get off his own offense. But the same thing has to be said. If Rinat's just throwing a lot of power punches and he's not able to get Mihailidis out of there, especially early, if he's throwing 130 power shots, I doubt he's going to look very good between minute 10 and 15 of this fight.
And when it comes to Fakhretdinov, a Pancration and Combat Sambo background, and the sketchy thing about him too, so offensively, you saw the combination against Spicely. He went left kick to the leg, he went left, and then he went right overhand, knocked him dead. He will back up on a straight line with his hands down and his head up, looking for the left hook counter that doesn't land every time. But occasionally what he'll do is he'll time that and fake it and go for the double leg takedown, and he gets it time and again. And the other thing about him, he's kind of like Judo Dan Kelly. He comes out with the leg braces, the knee wrap. So from Fakhretdinov, look for that. Training out of big gyms. Obviously, you see it in the picture, aka Thailand's the picture that I got of him, but also the American top teams of the world as well. I've seen Fakhretdinov. I've been talking about him for a year now, but I've seen him at Extreme Couture. I've seen him in Vegas at the PI getting ready with guys. For Mihailidis, he was an MMA Masters guy, but also training at home in EFL Martial Arts in Greece. So coming down to this fight, you look at the odds. Mihailidis open a plus 250, plus 227 right now in best fight odds. For Fakhretdinov, open to minus 300, minus 289. Looking at the Topology vote, surprise to us as they are to you, But I'm going to say over under 85% Fakhretdinov here.
I'll say slightly under.
Slightly over. Wow. 1,270 total votes, 91% Fakhretdinov, 74% by knockout for the 9% that have Mikhailidis, 51% by decision, 31% by knockout. So Matt, when it comes down to this pick, this fight's at welterweight. Throw everything out the door that you know about these two guys. I'd say take the under if I was really making a pick, because again, Mikhailidis doesn't have good cardio at 185 pounds.
Or a great chin.
170, it's probably not great. Fakhretdinov, it remains to be seen. What's the pick here?
I like Fakhretdinov in this, and people get on me all the time when I say this, and I think it's ridiculous. The UFC is a lot more like most boxing promotions than I think we realize. And guess what? You're right. They do have a hyped up prospect in one half of this fight. And I do think they are trying to give him not an easy fight for his first fight by any means. Because again, Mikhailidis is well-rounded. He's just weird. It's like, you ever play 3-on-3 in a park? And it's not like you're really playing 3-on-3. It's like there's 3 1-on-1s going on. That's like how Mikhailidis does MMA. He's gut hit all of his styles. There's just no synergy between any of them. And I do think Fakhretdinov can take advantage of that. But again, I will say this. His striking leaves massive holes open. So even if he does look really good in this fight and does get the knockout, he might still show some areas that could be taken advantage of by better fighters in the future.
Yeah, I mean, you look at some of the guys that Fakhretdinov's fought in the past. They're definitely guys that are brought in that are weight classes lower, beefed up to 185, and then he's beating them, taking them down, so on and so forth. I'll take Fakhretdinov in this fight just due to the strength of the camps, due to the layoff, but improvements that we could see. Usually around 30, you're not seeing giant leaps and bounds of improvements, but I think the takedowns are going to be big for him. And again, Mikhailidis lacking the in-betweens. Good at the jiu-jitsu, though, so we'll see how it plays out, but ever so slightly, I'm going with Fakhretdinov here, and I have so many things against him that I would stay away from this fight with Pop and the popcorn nearby. So both of us going with Gladiator, Rinat Fakhretdinov. It should be a big-time fight and a big-time main event between Alexander Volkov, old Drago. He's taking on Biggie Boy, Jairzinho Rhodes to strike. You're not going to want to miss this. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend at Flyweight, we have a couple of guys that just never want to let the party die between El Jefe Jeff Molina and Zhalga Zhumagulov. And I absolutely love this fight. I mean, at the channel with Fight Night Picks, we're big Flyweight fans. And when you look at the guys that are outside of the rankings that are knocking on that door, you know that they're out there to put on impressive performances. And for Jeff Molina, is there a little bit of that Dana White's Contender Series curse with him? I haven't seen it yet. He was able to knock down poor old Arichi Long 2 times in his first fight. That was a fight of the night at UFC 261. That was a giant card. When you factor in the fight that Molina was able to have, if I may, Matt, with the old stats, round number one, Jeff Molina lands 18 significant strikes. Round number two, 127 significant strikes and 2 knockdowns. And in that was in the third round. I have my numbers wrong, but in the second round, 44. So he goes from 18 to 44 to 127. Most guys unload the clip very early, especially when it comes to the fighters that we have coming up on this card this weekend. There's a lot of one-round fighters. Jeff Molina is not one of those guys, and I love that. And for Zhalga Zhumagulov, he's one of those fighters that always is very steady, always has a good gas tank unless he's getting finished. And realistically, you can make an argument that Zhumagulov won his UFC debut against Haolin Paiva. But then when it comes to his two other losses to Amir Albazi, he got out Zhumagulov in that fight. And then if you look at his last time out about 6 months ago against Manel Kopp, he got posterized by a man who weighed a little bit too much in that fight.
The strange thing about Zhumagulov is that he is well-rounded, but again, not any single one of his just attributes really stands out amongst the rest. I do just like his activity, and that's the good thing about Zhumagulov. He does move forward a lot, but he's one of these strange fighters who he'll crash and crash and crash, and it's almost like he crashes too much distance to where he can't get any extension on his own punches, and now he's just going for like weird high amplitude takedowns. And it does work against some guys, like the Jerome Rivera fight's a good example of that. But I think it's fair to say that Jeff Molina and Jerome Rivera are on very different levels as MMA fighters, because for Jeff Molina, other than the takedown defense potentially being an issue in this fight, just with the overall work rate of Zhumagulov and how wonky he is with the way he really does everything, I like Molina a lot in this fight. Like, this is the thing. Zhalgash Shumagulov is hittable. That is the one attribute that he carries into every single fight. He has sort of a stationary defense. It's not a defense that learns as the fight goes on. It's like the Justin Gaethje. I'm going to put my hands up. If you hit my hands, that's cool. If you don't hit my hands, you're probably going to hit my head. But with Shumagulov, I just don't think he's going to be able to make reads as this fight goes on. And the thing about Jeff Molina, you're right. His volume does get better as the fight goes on, but I think it is slightly different than that. I put Jeff Molina in like a Forrest Griffin category, to where the fight doesn't really start until he gets hit a couple of times. I think he will sort of fight in a more reserved pace early on in this fight, but I think once Zhalgash does start to hit him a couple times, once he does go for a takedown, I think he might be able to secure the takedown for a second, but I do think Molina, not only with his youth, he's so much bigger and more explosive in this matchup too. I think he's the much faster guy. I think he's gonna be the stronger guy too. So other than this just coming down to, can Zhalgash outgrind Jeff Molina? I do find myself liking a lot of Molina's singular stats a lot more than Zhalgash.
I will say this for Jeff Molina. I mean, you look at some of the fights that he struggled in, you look at some of the fights that he has won. Takedown defense is an issue, and I know he's a Glory MMA fitness guy, and that gym has so-so results. We're supposed to have another Glory guy this weekend who's a good ground fighter in Derek Minner. It's either live by the sword, die by the sword. But when you look at it for Jeff Molina, even in considering Dana White's Contender Series and UFC, Jacob Silva went 2-2 on takedown attempts. Again, Molina ends up winning that fight. And Arichi Long went 3-4, but not a lot of control time on the ground. Molina's able to pop right back up. Shumagulov's a different animal. And here, for you big fans of Mr. Zhalgash, I will give you the credit that you're seeking, and I know you're going to hit the comment section with this. Who has better wins in the resume? Zhalgash Shumagulov overwhelmingly. Tyson Nam, Tagir Ulambekov, and Ali Bagwatinov all in a row, Fight Nights Global champion at flyweight. When I was in midget AAA whip pitch, I played at Nationals, Matt. Do I talk about it
here? This is so embarrassing.
It has no bearing on anything. It was years ago. For Zhalgash Shumagulov, we haven't seen that same guy in the UFC. That's my point. So when you look at the fights that he's had, I thought he beat Halley and Paiva, but that's neither here nor there. We throw it out the window. He loses the other fights against Amir Albazi, a primary grappler who out-Shumagulovs him. He beats Jerome Rivera, who was here for a good time but not a long time in the UFC, and he loses to Manel Kopp. Jeff Molina is that perfect middle ground. So I have seen a lot of people talking about Shumagulov this week. We have a look at the odds. Molina open to minus 200, minus 186 as it stands. For Shumagulov, open to plus 170, plus 153. So a little bit coming in on Shumagulov. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you, Matt. I'm going to say over under 72.5% Molina.
Over.
You're going to say over. It is over. 1,323 votes. 87% Molina. 68% by decision for the 13% that have Shumagulov. About 60% by decision. So Matt, the fans seeing this one going the way of a decision to Jeff Molina, are you in agreement there?
So in baseball, if you want to throw a ball better, you put sticky stuff on your fingers and then it makes the ball spin a lot faster and it gives you the result that you want. In MMA, if you want to hit somebody harder, you can plant down and just throw as hard as you can, or you can make them come towards you and meet them halfway. Jeff Molina can strike on the back foot, and Zhalgash Shumagulov does rush forward recklessly quite a bit, and that's how I see this fight going. Could Zhalgash get takedowns in this fight? Yes, he can, but I think Molina's going to make him pay for every single entry he has. And let's say he is able to secure a takedown here or there. I don't think this control time that he'll be able to get is going to be able to negate the damage that Molina should be able to get off on the feet. Shumagulov is sort of an odd character to where, even go back to the submission he was able to get on Jerome Rivera, that weird standing guillotine, like, that was an awkward position. So if you are in one of those weird scrambles, then maybe Shumagulov could find a knack, but I still like Jeff Molina in this fight.
Initial knockdown for Kopp, and then the knockout for Kopp, but it's been about 6 months for Shumagulov, so the dome should be working. But the guy that I expected was Luke Voigt. The guy that I got was Mike Ford out of Shumagulov. That's the last baseball reference for me. I like Jeff Molina in this fight. The guy throws the kitchen sink at you. He's not a big kicker, but when it comes down to it, slicker hands, he's much faster, and he has good pop at the end of his shots. And when it comes down to the ground game, good in top control, not the best off of bottom, but he does have a good first move back up to his feet. We shall see how Shumagulov makes out with those chain wrestling takedowns since he's been training in the States some more. But both of us going with El Jefe Molina in this fight. Be sure to let us know down below in the comments section
who you have in some big-time fights on this card. A rematch years in the making between Felice Herrig and Karolina Kovalkiewicz in the co-main event. Dan Ige taking on Movsar Evloev, and in the main event, oh boy, it's Volkov and Rozenstruik. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, an absolute grappler's paradise. We have Johnny Munoz. His nickname's Kid Kvenbo because that was his dad's nickname, and his dad was pretty damn good at jiu-jitsu. Gonna be taking on Tony, no nickname, Gravely. And when it comes down to this fight, I absolutely love it. From Tony, I'd say you know exactly what you're going to get because he wrestled at Appalachian State. He was a D1 college wrestler, and he parlayed that into a great career on the regional scene, champion time and time again. And then he comes into the UFC and he really makes his mark. He's had a lot of very fun fights. And I know Brett Johns isn't in the UFC anymore, but that was a fight of the night in his debut. Lose that one by rear naked choke, but it was a lot of fun. Win over Geraldo de Freitas. Win over Anthony Burchak by knockout. Poor Anthony, his second time in the UFC, did not go well.
No, it did not.
A loss to Nate Maness, his second to last time out. And then a big win over Simon Oliveira. A fight that I think really pertains a lot to this matchup against Johnny Munoz Jr. But I say for Tony Gravely, I was given a bill of goods, and I've gotten what I expected out of it. But I will say, when you go back and look at Tony Gravely's fight that he has against Anthony Burchak, where he knocks him out, he then goes into the fight against Nate Maness like, okay, yeah, I'm a premier wrestler. I hold guys down, and I tire them out, and I just beat them down. And he went, okay, I'm a boxer now. I'm going to fight Nate Maness. And it worked out great in the first round against Maness. The last 2 seconds of that fight, it's just like Alejandro Perez when he fought Jonathan Martinez. Overhand right, ends the round, drops Nate Maness, does Tony Gravely. And you look at Maness, trying to clear the cobs with his face is right up against the cage. His corner just picks him up, throws him in the corner, puts him back on the stool. He gets back up, still looks like he's not totally there. And then they slug it out, and Maness ends up landing a shovel uppercut, drops Gravely, and then he finishes him. And the referee let it go a little bit longer than I would have enjoyed. But for Gravely, his next time out, he fights Simon Oliveira, a guy that fought on the regional scene, fought on Contender Series, had a lot of good front chokes, and that was pretty much the story of that fight. Gravely, wrestling, beating him down. Oliveira going like Anaconda, going guillotine. Gravely pulling out of it and ending up getting the win there. Taking on Kid Kvenbo in Johnny Munoz Jr., his dad runs the school that he had joined as a young boy, Sequence Jiu-Jitsu. He's a four-time All-State high school wrestler, was Gravely. But if you look at it for Munoz Jr., big-time multiple IBJJF champ in Jiu-Jitsu. So it's premier wrestling against premier Jiu-Jitsu. And for Munoz Jr., to look at him when he strikes, he doesn't look like a grappler. He looks like a karate guy maybe. He has a really weird stance, and I'm eager to see what we get out of him this weekend.
And that's the fun thing about this fight, like how you set it up. I do look at this fight as a primary grappler fighting a primary grappler. But if we did get 15 minutes of these guys striking, it wouldn't be a bad fight by any means. Yeah. It would still result in a fairly fun one, because for Gravely, you're right. It's very interesting, the career of Tony Gravely, and especially his UFC run, because it just kind of makes you think, okay, anytime you ever played a sport in your own life, when you tried too hard, what happened? You'd mess up, you'd make a mistake, you'd overthink it.
Kids swinging out of his shoes.
Someone would swing out of their shoes, you'd miss a curveball by 9 feet. Like, you would always make yourself look worse than you want to. But when you're just flowing with it, when you're just not really thinking about it, and you're just sort of letting the motions happen, then 9 times out of 10, nothing bad's going to happen. You're going to look really good. For Gravely, when he doesn't overthink things, I think he does get into that state to where, hey, he can strike and mix in his wrestling at the same time. He doesn't just go in there to box and then to wrestle if things go poorly. He goes in there to have an MMA fight. And I think if he goes in there with that kind of a mindset against Johnny Munoz Jr., he could have a ton of success. But this is the other thing about Gravely that I don't love in all of his fights, and I think you'll appreciate this. He does have good defensive grappling, I would say. He has been caught by submissions, don't get me wrong. But it seems like every fight he has ever been in, win, lose, or draw, he's caught in a guillotine for like 20 seconds. And he's fighting it, and fighting it, and fighting it. And there's always that like 5 second period where you're like, oh goodness, Tony just went for a takedown, now he's getting himself submitted. And I do really worry about that in this matchup, because against Munoz, I think Munoz is the level of grappler who is like a Nick Lentz against Will Brooks, for instance. I think he can allow Gravely to get on top of him, take him down, do some things in a way that might not actually help Gravely as this fight goes on. I think Munoz could set up traps as he allows Gravely to get on top of him. And I do think that as the fight progresses,
Because Gravely is one of these wrestlers who, if he gets 11 takedowns on you, you know he's going to go for the 12th one. I could see Munoz letting him take him down over and over and over again, just until he gets that perfect guillotine choke or that perfect defensive submission. It's almost like fighting like a grappling version of Uriah Hall, kind of, but I really think that could work out for him in this type of a matchup.
And for Munoz Jr., young enough, he's not one of those guys that as the fight goes on, usually for a grappler, you're at a disadvantage. Everybody gets sweaty and everybody gets tired, and it's just more difficult to sync up a submission. You look at Johnny Munoz Jr., the quality of grappler he is, and it really is something special. Now, if we go back through just the two UFC fights that he has had, you can make a very strong argument that he beat Nate Maness, but then the question is, okay, what's more effective? Stalling for the takedown to work it, or the little tiny shots that Maness was able to land? There was a low blow in the third round that resulted in a point deduction for Munoz, but there was a lot of questions as to whether or not he won that fight. So you could arguably say Munoz beat Maness. Gravely almost did, and then he got finished. It was like Daniel Rodriguez when he fought Dwight Grant. But you look at the last fight that Munoz had, and there's a big step up from the Wisconsin wrestler that is Jamie Simmons and Tony Gravely. But against Jamie Simmons, Johnny Munoz Jr. looked terrible in the first round. His accuracy was some of the worst volume striking I've ever seen. He was hitting at a, I think it was like a 17% clip, but it really was. He kept his hands right here, balls of his feet, jab to the air, right hand to the air, back to it, waiting to bait his opponent in. And then in the second round, he just went for his takedown, got it, took the back, and then it was a lot of hand fighting before he got the submission and tapped out Simmons. Johnny Munoz Jr. is that nth degree grappler, whereas Tony Gravely is that wrestler in this division, like a Cody Stamann, like these other guys at 135, Dan Argueta, that you're going to see later on in this card. Very, very similar fighters. So I look at the odds here. Gravely open to minus 150, favorite minus 142 right now. Johnny Munoz Jr. open to plus 130, plus 116. So odds shifting in favor of Kid Kvenbo. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 65% on the more familiar Tony Gravely.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It is over. 1,227 total votes. 71% Gravely. 84% by decision for the 29% that have Mr. Munoz Jr. 36% by decision. 44% by submission. So, Matt, the fans are in agreement with us, so it seems, and they're thinking that Munoz Jr. could pull out the submission victory. Do you think he's going to get it this weekend?
I agree with the layout of the topology votes. I really do, because again, I think Gravely's either going to win like a 30-26 type of decision, or go for that takedown, that last takedown he probably shouldn't, and find himself into a submission. I think it probably will be a one-way or another kind of a fight, sort of that one-way traffic. So that's why I'm going to pick Tony Gravely. Again, it's not my most confident pick on the card, because the one area in which he can have the most success is also going to put him into quite a bit of danger with Johnny Munoz Jr. But I do think Gravely on the feet can damage Munoz, to where I'm not sure if Munoz can put together enough shots to really hurt Gravely on the feet. It could happen. I've been wrong before. I'm sure I'm going to be wrong again. But if Gravely, let's say he does duck for a takedown, come over with an overhand right, that's a genuinely damaging strike that could change the whole outlook of this fight. So that's why I like Gravely in this matchup.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, Gravely with so much experience, 29 pro fights to the 12 of Munoz Jr. The only loss on Munoz Jr.'s record, you could argue he won it, but when it comes down to even just that singular fight that he lost, if he took on a guy like Tony Gravely, there's no way that fight would have taken place or gone the way that that one did. For Gravely, he can pretty well dictate the pace of this fight on the feet. He can dictate it with his wrestling, but then once he gets into that, we start to get into a gray area where Munoz's overall jiu-jitsu game could take over. So I like those parts of Gravely's game. I will pick him to win this fight, but like you said, this is one of the tougher ones on the cards. Both of us going with the man representing American Top Team in Tony Gravely, of no nickname. But you let us know down below in the comment section, because this is one of the fights that I'm most excited about coming up this weekend. We get some big ones on this card. Ige taking on Evloev in the co-main event. Rozenstruik challenging Mr. Alexander Volkov in that main event. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, Vyacheslav Kisilev is probably holed up in a cave somewhere watching this fight with great interest, as we have the God of War, Benoit Saint-Denis, representing France. He's taking on Germany's Green Mask, Nicolas Stutz, a couple of guys that I absolutely love to watch fight. And listen, this is an absolute clash of styles. I mean, for Benoit Saint-Denis, you saw it in his last fight. He has limited capability striking-wise. However, the judges gave him a round.
They give him a round. Some of them did.
He also lost two of them in, like, some of the most one-sided ways we've ever seen.
And the name that I brought up to start this video off, Vyacheslav Kisilev, he was the referee in that fight. And he let that fight go on for way too long. So for Santini, he took on godly amounts of punishment against Eliseo Zaleski de Santos in his debut. That fight was almost 7 months ago.
I thought it was longer ago than that.
Time for the brain to recover and heal. And if you look at it for Nicolas Stutz, his last time out was about 10 months ago when he got knocked out by Jared Gooden. Not Jared Gordon, Jared Gooden. And he got flatlined by old Jared. And listen, it was kind of one of those odd fights at 170 pounds. It meant a lot for both guys because it was to stick around in the division. Stutz gets another fight. Gooden got another one that he lost, and then he's out of the promotion. So it's funny how those things play out. But for Nicolas Stutz, it's really interesting. He's had two fights in the UFC. He fights Ramazan Ameev in his debut, and he gets taken down until the third round when Ramazan becomes a kickboxer, like all of his fights, and Nicolas looked pretty good in that opportunity. So what you know is that, A, Nicolas, he is a very, very good kickboxer. He went and had a lot of kickboxing fights before he became an MMA fighter. But he has good cardio and good staying power in his fights. But of course, last time out, he gets knocked out. But for Benoit Saint-Denis, a lot of the conversation this week, I'm sure, is going to be around his fight against Eliseo Zaleski de Santos. But this is a guy that over with Brave Siep before he came into the UFC, he was the premier super lightweight at 165 pounds. And even then, looked kind of stocky and bigger for that. This fight, according to Tapology, UFC stats, and the UFC press release, is at lightweight. So unless something changes, this one's at lightweight. So Matt, I expect Benoit Saint-Denis probably going to look pretty good at 155. I expect Nicolas Stutz is going to come in with one arm or one leg, because I don't know how he's going to make the weight class.
He is a much bigger fighter, and that will be interesting, because Saint-Denis did struggle with the size of Eliseo in that fight too, because he would go for a takedown attempt. He'd get the entry, get in on the hips, and Zaleski would just, like, chuck him off immediately because he was a lot bigger and quite a bit stronger in that fight. So I am curious to see if Stutz can have that similar kind of success if Saint-Denis is able to get on the inside of his range. Because for Stutz, he's one of these strange strikers who, at the distance of his strikes, he's great. But he doesn't have that Goldilocks zone on the inside. He's not like a Brian Ortega. And I'm always going to bring up Brian Ortega because he's by far the best example I can think of in MMA for this. I have long arms. I'm a really good boxer. Guys are going to try to get close to me to get on the inside of my reach, so I can't hit them. Well, I have an elbow right here that's half the distance, and I can hit really hard with those. If Stutz had an elbow that he could throw in the clinch, like, it would completely change the dynamic of his game, because a lot of people go in there fighting him thinking, hey, I'm going to eat one or two strikes on my way in, but the second I get inside of his kicking range, it makes the fight quite a bit easier. And for Saint-Denis, it will be interesting. I'm curious to see what his mindset is coming into this fight. I know this is more of a boxing thing than it is an MMA thing, but when you take a beating like he took in his last fight, you don't want to do it again. Remember Victor Ortiz? He was a really big deal.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite boxer of all time is Marcos Maidana. I think he's awesome. He only had crazy fights. He fought Victor Ortiz, and they dropped each other both like five times. It was a wild fight. But Maidana, in the middle rounds, starts beating the brakes off him, and Ortiz just decides, like, hey, I'm done. Like, I don't want to take beatings like this anymore. It really sucks. I don't like it. I'm not saying Saint-Denis is immediately going to become a fighter like that, but you always do have to question, how is a fighter going to come back off a beating like that? And yes, it has been, what, almost 7 months now, over 6 months. So hopefully he has been able to give his body time to heal. But that was a life-changing amount of damage. And it's hard to get that out of my mind, if I'm being honest, just because it was one of those fights, like you said, it should have been stopped multiple times before it ever got to the end of the third round. And he ate fight ender after fight ender. It wasn't just like he got hurt by a jab and he was on wobbly legs. Like, Eliseo's throwing seven punch combos and landing five or six of those strikes. So for Saint-Denis, I am really curious to see what version of him we do get in this fight, because if he does have an aggressive mindset to get on the inside, I think he'll have a lot of success. And I do like his lower center of gravity to maybe secure some of those takedowns. But let's say he does get hit one or two times early in this fight, and he's like, hey, this kind of sucks. I don't really like doing this anymore. It's happened to MMA fighters before. It's happened to fighters in general before. So it is just a question that I do want to bring up based off his last performance.
My big counter to that, or at least when you look at the style of Benoit Saint-Denis, it's kind of funny. You and I think that he's like a shorter, stockier guy. And at 170, kind of is pretty damn tall, and he's pretty damn long too. But the way that he fights with his judo background, now, he had that going into the military. 5 years he spent in French Special Forces. He worked on his jiu-jitsu there, goes to Venom Training Center, and the rest is history. Becomes a pro in 2019, debuts in the UFC in 2021, and he's already, what, 8-0 with a no contest that time? The no contest was against Paul Kislyak at Brave CF 28, and in that fight, clash of heads, disgusting cut on Saint-Denis' forehead, they end the fight, TKO due to doctor stoppage, and then it's overturned to a no contest because, of course, it was a clash of heads. And if you look at the last two fights that Saint-Denis had over with Brave, the fight against Luan Santiago, that was their former lightweight champ, and he was able to get a second-round arm triangle choke win in that one. His next fight out was against Arcates Ramos, and it's Ramos because he's from Spain. And against Arcates Ramos, that was a guy that, just like Nicklas Stutz, so Arcates, 23-3 in K1. He was a Spanish regional champ. Nicklas Stutz, 17-3, K1. Sneaky kicker. Saint-Denis was able to take him down really, really quickly, ground him out, and end up with an arm triangle choke as well. So I'm not saying that that's going to happen to Nicklas Stutz. Stutz has been training at Syndicate for some time. Like, I've been following him actively on the Instagrams. He's been working with, all the Syndicate guys. But a guy that I'm thinking good in the in-betweens, long for the divisions, Cowboy Cerrone. Seen him in some of those pictures, so you never know what could happen for Nicklas Stutz. But I look at the odds for this fight. Saint-Denis open to -275 favorite. -157 right now. Green Mask Stutz open +235. +129 right now. This fight at lightweight, I'm eager to see Nicklas Stutz. Like, what does he have to give to make the weight?
Was it Jesse Iaria?
Yeah.
He fought Stevie Ray, and that was a wild weight cut because he fought Darren Till at welterweight, and he looked like very similar to Darren Till when they fought. Then he made 155. Just the first guy who came to mind. But you're right. He's going to be massive for this division. But this also has to be said, and I think we'll both agree on this. This is the CM Punk Jeff Hardy 2009 steel cage match of this card, without a doubt. Luz is probably going home, so this is a very important fight for both fighters in their careers. But the whole reason I bring up sort of the mentality behind Benoit Saint-Denis is because I think he's going to win this fight if it does not come down to him maybe having a similar experience to the Elizio fight. I like his grappling quite a bit in this matchup, and I think he's going to be the faster fighter at getting into his entries on the inside. Now, if he does find himself in a kickboxing match in the center of the cage, then yes, I could see him getting his legs kicked and being susceptible to some of the kicking attacks of Nicklas Stutz, but I still like Saint-Denis grappling overall.
Stutz's last fight at lightweight was back at Bama 30. Remember Bama? A lot of fun. He lost by unanimous decision to 11-12-1 Chris Stringer. Chris Stringer. I have been on Saint-Denis just based on the groundwork. I know for Stutz in the camp with the investments, he's got now 2-0 outside of the UFC in 2022. Sasha Palatnikov there to train with, but also Armin Zarukian. So we'll see how the takedown defense stands up. But Saint-Denis is one of those grapplers that, yes, he has judo. Yes, he has jiu-jitsu in his back pocket. He is a bodyweight takedown, all my force and might into my double leg to get guys down. So we'll see how the gas tank plays out for either guy. We'll see who's the weight bully. Will it be Khabib grappling with Luke Rockhold all over my Reddit? Maybe, but I do have France's God of War, Benoit Saint-Denis, to get the win, his first in the UFC. Matt, you're in agreement here?
I agree.
Both of us in agreement. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight and many more to come, because there's 14 on this card. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Zaruk Adashev is UFC winless no more, and he's looking to keep the role going with a win over weight bully Ryan Benoit his last time out for Adashev, the former longtime kickboxer. And this is a guy that was competing up multiple weight classes and winning titles back when he was a kickboxer. My favorite fight to go back and watch, he was 16-3 in that discipline, 10 wins by knockout. His fight against Jeffrey Thien with Glory, where he throws a spinning back kick and knocks him dead, that's a lot of fun to watch.
Awesome.
I like Bazooka Joe Valtellini because he's Canadian. I like Todd Grisham because he has fun.
He just has fun.
Get out of there, Travis!
That happened when we were there in Halifax. But really, references
How much
aside,
money did he have on that fight? Because just from his voice, it sounds like he had the house on Travis Brown.
It was a short time but a good time when Todd Grisham did UFC fights. But for Zaruk Adashev, in MMA, it's weird, right? Level competition over with Bellator. He beat 0-2 Ron Leon back in 3 years ago. Then he took on Tevin Dice, who was 3-1, and it was a back-and-forth fight, but he does get the finish at the end. Then he fights Tyson Nam on short notice and loses by knockout very quick, misses weight. Fights Sumedergy and gets outstruck in a discipline that he should be a specialist at. And then he beats Ryan Benoit in a fight that really captivated audiences because it was a 3-3 fighter beating a guy who had a semi-decent level competition in the UFC. And now Zaruk Adashev goes on to take Ode Osborne, former bantamweight, now flyweight, who's had mixed results in the UFC. And this is such a weird fight, man.
It is, but I gotta be honest, I'm fairly excited for it. Because out of Ode Osborne, I don't watch his fights and think, oh wow, how's this guy gonna get into the top five of the division? I just like watching him fight.
Conor McGregor does. And it should be noted, what? This is an Ode Osborne card and not a Conor McGregor card. Continue.
Sure. The thing about Ode Osborne, though, is he is a really good long-distance striker. But again, he's one of these fighters who... he kind of proves that reach is a benefit and also a disadvantage. Like, reach people look at and think, oh, if you have a longer reach, it's immediately beneficial. It's not. Reach is just a statistic about yourself, and that's it. It comes down to how you are able to use your reach. And for Ode Osborne, if he's able to get his boxing combinations going with an opponent up against the cage, it basically looks like he's standing at the middle of the cage, hitting them from across the ring. That's how good his outside boxing is. But the problem is that when you're someone like he is, who does plant on his power shots and does throw some of those looping strikes, a faster striker on the inside is always going to be able to take advantage of you. And that's not even the only issue Ode Osborne has. He is a very good striker offensively. He does have some liabilities, let's say, defensively. He can also get held down in a lot of his fights too, and I don't think that's going to be that big of a factor against a guy like Zaruk Adashev, who the comparison is almost like if Tyreek Hill just decided to play basketball. Like, he can still run, he's still fast, like, I'm sure some of the things translate, but it's not your sport, you know? And that's what it is with Adashev. He very much is a pure striker who is now just fighting in an MMA cage. It's not that he can't grapple, but let's be honest, it's going to be an issue for him against pretty much anybody at this level, and I'm really glad how you would explain that Sue Muttergy fight, because that's kind of where I was going with it. I think you'll agree with me. The Sue Muttergy loss was way worse for Zaruk Adashev than the Tyson Nam one was. Tyson Nam hit him with a clean shot that could put down a horse. It could have knocked anybody out. Sue Muttergy convincingly outstruck him round after round after round, and he wasn't just doing it with big power shots like you would expect from the bigger fighter. He was able to do it technically, and he was able to use his volume, and the thing I really liked out of Muttergy in that fight was he used his feet. He was able to use his footwork to really counteract the footwork of Zaruk Adashev. Now, Sue Muttergy doesn't really strike in the same way Ode Osborne do. Physically, I would say, frame-wise, they're kind of similar. But Osborne is a much more stationary target. So I do think he's going to be much more available to hit for Adashev than someone like Muttergy was in their fight.
Yeah, and if you look at Zaruk Adashev, typically when it comes to his kickboxing, it kind of translates in his MMA fights. Good pressure, good lead right hook. He can follow it up with whatever the hell he wants because he's so compact for the division. And oh, by the way, he just happens to have that kickboxing lineage like an Israel Adesanya, like Alex Pereira, but it does translate well into his MMA fights. You saw that his last time out against Ryan Benoit. For Ode Osborne, I love his win on Dana White's Contender Series over Armando Villarreal, where he's able to get the submission. I like his fight against Jerome Rivera, who we mentioned earlier on in this card. He fought Jalgeir
Shimomurov. For all the wrong reasons, Jerome Rivera didn't win. Talked about.
And Ode's last time out beat CJ Vergara, but let CJ back into the fight as it went on in the later stages of that one. So you look at the odds for this fight. Osborne opened a sizable favorite, a minus 280, minus 177 right now for Adashev. The Lion opened a plus 240, plus 145. So we're going to have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say just based on record alone being 10-4 with no contest to 4-3, I'm going to say over under 70% Osborne.
I'll say under.
I'm going to say under. It's way over 1,302 total votes, 90% Osborne, 47% by decision, 41% by knockout for the 10% that have Zaruk Adashev, 62% by decision, 22% by knockout. I think Zaruk Adashev beats Ode Osborne, he knocks him out. That weight cut can't be easy for Osborne.
I don't know if he has to knock him out, though. I think we're both kind of thinking along the same lines, but I guess this is how I see this fight. I think it's going to be an awful fight. I think styles make fights 9 times out of 10, and I don't think stylistically these guys are going to make for a great fight, and please allow me to explain myself. Zaruk Adashev is a very good striker, like you had said. Does he throw nearly as many strikes as you would like, though, from a pure striker? Not really, and he is someone who... maybe it's not all wasted movement, but he does like to move his feet quite a bit in his fights. I could see this being a fight where Osborne hits him with maybe a good shot in the first 15 seconds, and then Adashev just stays on his bike for a lot of it. Because Osborne does have a tendency to just follow his opponent. He's not great at cutting off the cage. And I think if he doesn't cut off the cage effectively, we're probably just going to see Adashev get on the inside, land a couple strikes, get back on the outside. I don't really expect a finish out of this fight. And even though the records are kind of deceiving, I'm going to pick Zaruk Radishev just because stylistically, I think he can use his mobility to just stay out of the range of Ode Osborne.
Yeah, like I'm right on the fence on this one. I like Ode Osborne in terms of he has the submission abilities. Is his wrestling all there? Not necessarily. And Zaruk Radishev, when you're a kickboxer, we talked about this in the past, bit us with Elise Reed when she took on a really tough Sam Hughes. But when you're a kickboxer, all you're going to train more than likely is your takedown defense. For Zaruk Radishev, it is what it is. But I think Ode Osborne has that X factor to his game. But his striking leaves a lot to be desired. So we're split on the pick. Matt going with Uzbekistan's own Zaruk Radishev. And I'm going to go with the Jamaican sensation representing Pura Vida BJJ in Ode Osborne. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. I think this is going to be an interesting fight. We have some big time ones on the rest of this card. And in the main event, Volkov Rozenstrike, a big time one at heavyweights. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, all the crazy things I did tonight, those would be the best memories. We have the determined Dan Argueta. He's taking on Damon Jackson, the Leech, on incredibly short notice, replacing Derek Minner. Everybody likes Derek Minner. And realistically, for the former, and I should say current, but he's going to have to vacate the belt, the LFA Bantamweight champ, Dan Argueta. It really is an interesting one. I mean, listen, he looks like if Aaron Jeffrey was evolved, I guess Dan Argueta, if you really kind of grabbed him and made him bigger, he's Aaron Jeffrey, Bellator's own. Or you could consider Dan Argueta in the way that he fights, because he did shave that lovely mop of hair for his LFA return. Because for Argueta, he looked like that with hair when he went on The Ultimate Fighter, the latest season. Not the one that's taping right now, but season 29, took on Ricky Tercios, lost by unanimous decision. That's the only L, so to speak, close to proximity in his pro record. 8-0 as a pro. Goes back to LFA. Rings off three straight wins. The guy's as serious as a Questrade commercial. Questrade. Aaron Jeffrey.
I play games. Just not with my money. Okay.
That's the second Canadian reference. The third Canadian reference for you folks out there. You guys are going to love this one. Dan Argueta. The nickname's The Determined. It's like a Cora's menu item. Like Lewis the Undecided is a breakfast item you can get at Cora's. Dan the Determined. Pick a new nickname. It's awful, Matt. But Dan Argueta, lots of parts of his game that I like. He's a main training partner of Cub Swanson. However, he's a Jackson Wing staple. And when I look at Dan Argueta, he is a two-time Illinois AAA state qualifier in wrestling. And when you watch him fight, he reminds me a hell of a lot of Cody Stamen.
So why is he fighting Damon Jackson in his UFC debut?
Because they needed a warm body.
And I understand, but that's the thing. Damon Jackson, I feel like the rep amongst MMA fans looks at Damon Jackson as just another guy. I don't feel like we do give him the flowers he deserves. And I don't think Damon Jackson, to put it into NBA terms, is like an all-star by any means. And like, he's probably a guy coming off the bench he really liked, though. He's like Jordan Clarkson.
The guy's 24-1 with a no contest.
And none of his fights have ever been boring. And that's the thing about Damon Jackson. He doesn't get tired as the fight goes on. He doesn't have a single part of his game that is a massive weakness. Striking defense, but he has a great chin and his own striking is really good. And he has really good cardio. And that's the big thing I always go back to. 9 times out of 10, when we see a fighter struggle against someone making their debut, it's the fighter who already had the full game plan, already had the full camp, already normally has cardio issues going into that fight, and it's something that this new person can take advantage of. Damon Jackson can drag anybody into deep waters. I don't care who they are. He could drag a shark into deeper waters. That's how good Damon Jackson's gas tank is. So I do worry if Argueta can't get him down early on in this fight and just really impose his will. I don't know how Jackson can't just continue to volume strike forward. Just threaten enough with a few defensive submissions here or there. Just keep the fight at his own pace.
Dan Argueta. He was the number one pick of Team Ortega. Brian Ortega had a bad picks that year. He was awful compared to Volkanovski. It's like he didn't do his homework and he was focused on the belt. Cortez? I don't know. Whatever. But when it does come down to Argueta, you look at those 3 wins that he had over with LFA very, very recently, 7 months ago, a win over Rodney Mandela, who's 6-3. Then he beats Myron Santos. And in that fight, his opponent was very, very young. He gets a win in that one. Then he takes on Diego Silva for the belt, wins by split decision. This is my takeaway from those 3 fights and the rest of Dan Argueta's career. Does he have a wrestling advantage over 99% of the guys that he fights? 110%. Power wrestler. I made the Cody Stamen reference because
Stamen, Alex Munoz, perhaps?
Stamen pops in and out of the pocket, and he's not super hittable. He's become more hittable as his career has gone on. But in and out of the pocket, Arquette is very fast, but he can wrestle, and he can chain it together and hold guys down, really impose his will. But when I look at his last fight against Mr. Silva, I had Silva round one, and I had Silva round two, and in a three-round fight, that's all that matters. And for Argueta, he is a developing striker. I think that California connection away from Jackson Wink is good for him, but he has got to be one of the most hittable prospects I've ever seen. He just stands there and eats shots. And you heard the commentary team with LFA in his last fight in the second round go, well, it was Alan Joban, to be specific. He's got to bring his hands up. He's got to move his head. He's got to stop eating these shots and walking into them. And it's very troubling to see that. Then going up a weight class on a week's notice against Damon Jackson. Is Damon Jackson the best fighter you've ever seen? Not necessarily. 24-1 with a no contest. Obviously, the no contest, he got beat, but it was overturned. And one of his knockout losses, one of the most disgusting or coolest knockouts you've ever seen, against eventual PFL champ Mavlid Haibulayev. But for Jackson, I get it. The one loss in the UFC in the return, said two stints, is to Ilya Topuria, who's disgusting in the short range when it comes to his wrestling. But the wins, Mirsad Bektic, that was a comeback, pretty good submission win. The win over Charles Rosa, where he's leaking blood in the third round and they let it go. And then his win over Cam Wallace-Kirk. Cam Wallace-Kirk's a hell of a fighter. I like Cam Wallace-Kirk more than the average
bear. I don't know if he's a hell of a fighter just because you like him, though.
I think it's like a renaissance, new age version of like a, I don't know, pick a guy. Carlos Condit's my comp. I like the body kicks. Kind of looks like him a little bit. But Damon Jackson is a finisher to the nth degree, especially when it comes to taking the fight to the ground. And he's good off his back. And he's a lot bigger than Dan Argueta. I have a hard time seeing Damon Jackson like losing this fight.
This isn't a UFC entry-level opponent, I don't think. Maybe you think of Damon Jackson that way, but personally, I don't. I just think it's almost like Daniel Rodriguez when you give him a UFC debut. It's just there's some people who are too well-rounded and too experienced to just give somebody off the street. And again, not that Argueta is just coming off the street, but I do worry about him in this fight against Damon Jackson, who doesn't have that one weakness that you could just fall on and think, hey, as long as he can get him down early, he should have success. Like you said, Damon Jackson can grapple off his back, and I do expect him to do quite a bit of that in this fight early on, but I do think he'll be able to defend those takedowns as the fight progresses and just get his own striking off as this fight goes on.
All the crazy things I did tonight, those would be the best memories. For Argueta, opens a plus 170 underdog, plus 334 at the time of this taping on Monday night. For Damon Jackson, minus 200 all the way up to a minus 450. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there to you. I threw this one out there on Instagram and a few people said, hey, I like the prospect, but I'm going to say over under 85% Jackson.
I'll say over.
And it is slightly under. What, 859 total votes, 83% Jackson, a large 65% by submission for the 17% that have Argueta, 49% by decision, 27% by knockout. If Dan Argueta knocks out Damon Jackson, I'll do a shot of, I don't know, Magnum 357 hot sauce. I have some of that here. If it happens, I'd be very surprised. I have Jackson to win this fight. Stay away from it. Again, Argueta fought a five-round title fight 3 weeks ago. So cardio, you know it's going to be there. But hopping up to 145, I think Jackson's going
to
get the win.
I expect Daniel Argueta to be around for a little while in the UFC. I just don't think this is going to be his night because this is a huge step up in competition and up a weight class, like you had said. So I do like Damon Jackson quite a bit in this fight.
Neither one of us going with the smaller iteration of Aaron Jeffrey. We both have the Leech Damon Jackson to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this matchup and a big time pairing at featherweight. We get some big time fights left on this card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Interesting fight coming up this weekend. We have Joe Selecki taking on Alex Leko da Silva, and I'm going to take you on a little bit of a journey because personally, I remember Alex da Silva's UFC debut more than I should. It was a card in which Alistair Overeem fought Alexei Olenek in a main event. That really happened 3 years ago. Go back and watch it. And for Alex da Silva, I was sold this flashy striker, this big-time finisher. He was, what, 20-1? And he was 23 years old, and he was going to come in and rock and shock the world. And realistically, for da Silva, he's had some big time matchups in his young UFC career. And even bigger than the matchups are some of the fights that have fallen out. Like, he was booked in a fight against Mr. Fazeev and it didn't happen. So what does he get? He gets Kasula Vargas and he beats him. He was then booked to fight Tristan Connolly. That fight doesn't happen. Who does he fight? Brad Riddell. And he beats him for a round. He beats him for the first round. But what I was sold with Da Silva coming into the UFC was flashy first round finisher of a striker. He has some submissions available to him, but he represents Astra Fight Team. You know Astra Fight Team. They have a title challenger coming up on the next pay-per-view card, taking on Valentina Shevchenko. It's Tyler Santos' Astra Fight Team. So big time opportunities for Da Silva. Fights Alexander Yakovlev. And listen, commentary teams all over it. Yakovlev, this is a guy that has on his mantle Gray Maynard. He's fought Damian Maia. Yakovlev.
Got dropped by Damian Maia, the first punch he threw.
And this fight was in Russia, so it was a big deal for Yakovlev. But in that fight, to start it off, Da Silva looks pretty damn good. And then Yakovlev rallies back a little. Da Silva gets caught in like a weird point where he's crouched up against the cage. Yakovlev goes... They have it as a guillotine over on Tapology, but realistically, it is one of the funkiest chokes, and it was a setup like he was going to go Anaconda, but he didn't. Either way, Yakovlev gets the tap, and he gets the win. So, again, picking up the pieces, you've got Da Silva, goes in and fights Kasula Vargas, gets a win. It is what it is. Then he out-wrestles Brad Riddell in the first round. Riddell was a -320 favorite. Going back to the stool between round one and round two, Riddell's like, holy crap, I didn't think this was going to happen this way.
And then lights him on fire.
Yeah, and then Riddell rallies right back. So Da Silva, again, his record can be deceiving because he has 17 first-round finishes and 13 of them are by knockout. But he's decided to wrestle in the UFC, and I'm very surprised to see or eager to see what he'll bring against Joe Selecki, because if he decides to wrestle against Selecki, he's probably going to get submitted too.
This is my whole thing about Alex Da Silva. You bring up he won a round against Yakovlev and he won a round against Riddell. You're right. But that's just because he puts all of his energy into those first 5 minutes, and that's it. That's really all he has. And sometimes you can point and say, oh, this person won a round, they looked really good. Da Silva straight up only has 5 minutes of sustainable output in his whole game. It is interesting, because like you said, he has relied a lot more on his wrestling at the UFC stage of his career, or at least a lot more than I ever thought he would. Because against someone like Brad Riddell, yes, you're probably not going to want to strike with him for long periods of time, but I did expect Da Silva to at least stay on the outside, try to bounce a little bit more on the feet, just get the respect out Brad Riddell in some kind of a striking exchange, but that wasn't really his game plan whatsoever, and if he comes into this fight fighting like he did against Brad Riddell, Joe Selecki's going to get the easiest guillotine choke he has ever seen in his whole entire life. And here's the thing about Joe Selecki. We were just on the UFC stats page, so I saw Jeff Molina's name. Jeff Molina and Joe Selecki's fighting style will never get confused for each other, ever. Like, Joe Rogan always says, oh, if you saw Cub Swanson's silhouette, you know exactly who it is. You might think Joe Selecki's asleep if you saw his silhouette, because he is not the most entertaining fighter. Now, it doesn't matter. Wins and losses are all we keep track of in this sport. But Selecki is one of these control over submission grapplers. And it's not a knock against him, but even go back to the Jim Miller fight. Miller...
It's so impressive.
It is. I would never recommend somebody rewatch that fight. We do it so you guys don't have to. But he gets on top of Jim Miller. He holds half guard. He threatens enough to pass, or at least to switch position, to not get the fight stood back up to the feet. But that's about it from Joe Selecki. And I was someone who was in the camp of Selecki could become like a Pat Sabatini, maybe, if he just put the striking together. They have similar styles of grappling. Maybe you could see sort of the evolution of Selecki. We just haven't really seen his hands grow at all at the UFC level, and that really is going to have to be his next addition to his game if he does want to be taken seriously as a contender, because Jared Gordon was able to expose him somewhat in their fight. Jared Gordon fights like Jim Miller fought in like 2012, kind of. He'll wrestle, he'll grapple, and his way of just being well-rounded and outboxing Joe Selecki really gave Selecki issues when he was trying to get his own takedown attempts. So I like the things I like out of Selecki. It's just there's so much that's missing out of his overall MMA game. I do find it hard to pick him with a lot of confidence in this matchup.
Yeah, like I look at Da Silva's win over Kasula Vargas, noted brawler boxer type. And in that fight, 3 of 4 on takedown attempts, 12 minutes and 1 second of control time. If Alex Da Silva does that to Joe Selecki this weekend, color me surprised.
He gets tapped.
Like, I just don't see it. I mean, you look at Selecki, Jim O, John Salter's the head guy at that gym. You look at it, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt for Selecki. He's grown a beard now. He's a father. Things are changing for Joe Selecki. The guy's a man. He's a man. And listen, for Da Silva, I wish we get to see him more often because I think part and parcel, he is an interesting prospect. I mean, going into his fight against Kazula Vargas, Michael Bisping was polishing that up. He was all over it, saying how big of a prospect he was. You look at the fight that, you know, Mr. Selecki, or rather, Mr. Da Silva was supposed to have last year. It fell out, but Devontae Smith, no longer with the UFC, Devontae Smith. But that would have been a fun one. But I look at this fight, Matt. Selecki open to minus 245 favorite, minus 175 right now for Da Silva. Open to plus 205, plus 145 at this current juncture. Over-under on Tapology. Surprise us, it is to you. I'm going to say over-under 72.5% Selecki.
I'll say over.
The fans say over. 1,252 total votes, 83% Selecki, 73% by decision. For the 17% that have Da Silva, 57% by decision, 19% by knockout. Listen, I will say this. Alex Da Silva is a better striker than Joe Selecki. We know this. And in the first round, could you catch Joe Selecki taking pictures?
Without a doubt.
Smelling the flowers? Yeah, he could. So that is a definite possibility. I like the evolution of a grappler that Alex Da Silva, the added components to his game. That's something that could take you far, but not against Joe Selecki. So, I have Selecki in this fight.
I have Selecki in this fight, too, but we need to see a new part of his game if he does want to get out of sort of this.
I don't think we ever will.
I don't think, okay, but he's still young, and that's why I posed the question, whether you think he can or not. We've seen crazier things than someone at the age of 28 add a striking component to their game. Charles Oliveira went from not really knowing what he's doing on the feet to dropping Justin Gaethje and choking him out. So anything could happen in MMA. It's just that needs to be the next evolution in Selecki's game, because right now, he's almost like the male version of like an Aaron Blanchfield, if you will. He needs the takedown. He needs the top control, because there really is no plan B yet in his career. I still think the plan A will be good enough for all the reasons you had laid out as well. So I do like Joe Selecki, but this should be an interesting fight.
Blanchfield's got the left head kick. Joe Selecki's got jab. So we'll see what happens coming up this weekend. Both of us going with the man out of North Carolina, Joe Selecki, to get the win. Let us know who you have in this one. Is it Brazil's Leco Da Silva, or is it Jim O. Selecki? We got some big time fights left on this card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, the rematch you didn't know you needed. We have the little bulldog, Felice Herrig, taking on the former title challenger, Karolina Kovalkiewicz. And when it comes to the 5-on-in for both these fighters, it's so sketchy. It's so sketchy. For Kovalkiewicz, her fit-to-last fight was the fight against Jessica Andrade, where the lights went out in Georgia, or wherever they went out, and it was not good. And then since then, it's been sketchy. She loses to Michelle Waterson. She loses to Alexa Grasso. She takes ungodly amounts of punishment against Yan Xiaonan 2 years and 3 months ago, takes a long time off, and then about 9.5 months ago, she fights Jessica Penne. And in that fight, listen, Kovalkiewicz talked about retirement after the Yan Xiaonan fight. She had a kid at one point. Like,
she talked about retirement throughout her career, and that, not to steal this from you, but it has been weird, and that's never something you like to hear. Retire one time, that's fine. But after you come back, and then you have another loss, you talk about retirement again, then you have another loss, you talk about retirement, it feels like Karolina Kovalkiewicz is playing her future off the results at this point, not based off of what she wants in her MMA career.
Now, she still trains out of Poland, but as well at American Top Team, so you like to see that. And she's getting ready in Florida for this fight. But Kovalkiewicz's last fight against Jessica Penne, you think, okay, when it comes to striking, Jessica Penne's got one or two moves, and then we got to get to the ground. I mean, that's how she, you know, got her bread buttered with Invicta on The Ultimate Fighter, that crazy fight with Randa Markos, and then the long time off, and so on and so forth. But Jessica Penne, ground fighter. Karolina Kovalkiewicz somehow gets Jessica Penne to, like, accept guard, and she drops, and then she's just laying down on her back and going, hey, Karolina, come on. And Karolina goes, fight IQ, I don't need that. I'm going into Penne's guard. And they kind of wrestle around, but ultimately, Penne's just threatening armbar after armbar, and then finally she gets the armbar win over Kovalkiewicz. And it was like, well, I know Karolina is a kickboxer. I know exactly what I like to see when she's on. And you could see flashes of that at the start of the Penne fight. She's moving great side to side. She still has speed. She's popping her shots out there, but not really landing much. But then when it comes to that ground opponent, like, it's just so odd to see such a former high-level fighter make such a mistake that you wouldn't expect it of her.
There's no aggression in Karolina Kovalkiewicz anymore. Like, that was her calling card when she first got her title shot against Joanna. It was, hey, she moves forward. She doesn't stop. It's a lot of clinch. It's a lot of forward pressure. It was like kind of the Hall of Fame version of a smaller Joanne Calderwood, if you will. But Karolina, after that Jessica Andrade knockout loss, has never been the same fighter. And this isn't just me saying it. I highly recommend you go back and watch a lot of her fights. Even in that fight against Jessica Andrade, she's throwing strikes with her eyes completely closed. And I know it's easy for me to say who's never fought Jessica Andrade inside of a cage. Because, hey, she knocked
us both out the same night.
It'd be insane. Jessica Andrade, one of my all-time favorite fighters to watch. And she is great to watch, has incredible power. We all know how good Andrade is. I really do think she changed the career of Karolina Kovalkiewicz, though, and this is something that I talked about earlier on in the Benoit St. Denis fight, because I was going to also bring it up in this matchup. Karolina has not been the same fighter whatsoever since the Andrade fight, and I do think it did affect her. And like you said, with her kind of throwing her fight IQ out the door, it's not even just that fight against Jessica Penne. There's been multiple instances throughout Karolina's career to where she'll just sort of make a mistake at the worst possible time. Almost liken it to like Edson Barbosa. Barbosa had that stretch where he fought Tony Ferguson, even against Dan Hooker, where he's lighting him up on the feet, then goes for a takedown for no reason. Like, there's always that one spot in his fight where you're like, hey, Edson, what are we doing? But with Karolina, she doesn't have the X factor that sort of got her to the dance in the first place. Like, I talk about Tyreek Hill, it'd be like if John Morant didn't have hops. We all know John Morant because he can dunk on people. If he all of a sudden was just like, nah, I shoot mid-range jump shots now, we'd all be asking what the heck he's doing. For Karolina, now she is almost like an outside boxer. She doesn't really want to engage as much with her opponents. And I do think a lot of that is attributed to the damage that she has taken throughout her career. So I think Karolina's the more skilled fighter in this matchup based on the fighters we have seen in their past. But Karolina is nowhere near the fighter that she once was when she was making her way up the rankings.
She had a fight of the night at UFC 201 against Rose Namajunas. And then she fought Jessica Andrade she fought Joanna Jędrzejczyk. All three judges' scorecards, 49-46, and that fight to now, she's 2-7. So it has not been very kind to Karolina Kovalkiewicz. Her last win was over Felice Herrig, and that fight was 4 years and a month ago. For Felice Herrig, her last win 4 years and 5 months ago was against one Courtney Casey. Cast iron Courtney Casey. It was arguable. Again, the fight between Herrig and Kovalkiewicz was a split decision, but I thought Kovalkiewicz won round one and round two. It is what it is. But Matt, for Felice Herrig, major injury. She's had a lot of knee problems in the past 4 years. She loses to Michelle Waterson 3 years, 7 months ago. She fights about a year, 9 months ago against Vina Janjanova. Gets taken down and submitted. So you don't really get to learn a whole lot about Felice Herrig. And for both these fighters, these are strikers. Felice Herrig came into MMA as what, Matt?
A Thai boxer.
A Thai boxer. And you see that in not just her Instagram pictures, which are what they are, and what she does a lot on the Instagrams and the socials, but...
What does she do, Craig? I don't know. I don't have Instagram.
I don't know. Only about the fans, Matt. Only about the fans. But for Felice Herrig, very much a striker in her own game, but my God, she doesn't fight very often.
No, like, again, I don't know what anybody's expecting from this fight. Like, sometimes Michael Chandler fights Justin Gaethje, and we get up here, and we're so excited this fight can go any different way. Felice Herrig and Karolina Kovalkiewicz are going to get into a lot of 50-50 exchanges. That's the only thing I feel comfortable saying. Because Karolina, again, very hesitant at this stage of her career, but Felice Herrig uses her feet way too much. She doesn't sit down on any power shots. I always go back to the Courtney Casey fight where they're just like flipping each other off in the strangest, most like over-emotional way possible, and they're not really doing anything outside of just their taunting. So, like, I don't really know what anybody's going to expect from this fight, because you have two fighters who are nowhere near the prime of their careers at this stage, who just seem to be giving another shot. Like, this is like if Rampage fought Forrest Griffin in, like, 2015.
Give him Vanderlei again and make him fight this year.
It's just, this is the most Bellator UFC fight you're ever going to see.
So the odds in this one, Herrig opened to plus 100, minus 127 for Kovalkiewicz. Opened to minus 120, plus 103. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise to us there to you. Matt, I say a lot of fans flip coins. I'd say more than pick Kovalkiewicz. I'm going to say 65% over-under.
I think it'll be close to 50.
60% Kovalkiewicz, 40% Herrig. This fight was formally announced here in the last like week or two, so this is a really, really weird one. And if you want me to make this one fun and you made it this far, I remember when Karolina Kovalkiewicz fought Michelle Waterson like it was yesterday, because I was in the back of a rental car on my phone on the way from seeing Adam Doliak make his Grand Ole Opry debut. I saw Mason Ramsey that night and Kelly Pickler. Matt was there with me. Matt, you remember that night?
Kelly Pickler. Beautiful.
That was the night that our grandmother decided Tony Ferguson, Anthony Pettis is too much for me. I don't need to see Khabib fighting Conor McGregor.
Can you blame her? She is an elderly woman who witnessed two people beat each other to, like, the brink of death.
Yep, boys, it's time to go to bed. So, when it comes to this fight, Matt, what's the pick?
There's no winners in this, Craig. This is one of these picks where we're going to look dumb no matter what.
I'm taking Felice Herrig.
I'm probably going to also take Felice Herrig because, again, she resembles the fighter that she once was a little bit more closely than Karolina Kovalkiewicz. And I agree with you. I thought Kovalkiewicz won their first fight quite comfortably, if I'm being quite honest. It was a fun back and forth fight, but Kovalkiewicz had a lot of success with her Thai elbows on the inside. I do expect her to have some success with those again. I just don't think she's going to be comfortable at that range to keep on going back to the well over and over and over again. So I guess I'll agree with you. I've got Felice Herrig.
Both of us going not comfortable. Like, I don't, what word do you use?
Just, I don't know.
We're going with the little bulldog, Felice Herrig, to get the win.
You know that song by The Weeknd? I'm out of time. Both these fighters are out of time, okay? I'm very surprised they're still in the organization.
All right, we're out of time. Enjoy the rest of the card. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend at light heavyweight, we have Atomic Alonzo Menafield taking on No Mercy Askar Mazhirov, a man who withstood a name change as a professional fighter. He's also possibly 29-7 or 21-8.
That's Johnny Eduardo. That's what we call it.
It is hard to say what his overall record actually is, but the UFC have it listed. Sherdog have it listed, and multiple others at 21-8. And I apologize to our audio-only listeners over on iTunes and Spotify, but Askar Mazhirov does not look like the guy in our graphic that I have next to us, and I did that as a point because this is a guy that used to fight at welterweight, then he fought at middleweight, he's fought at light heavyweight, and most recently, he fought, and I want to make sure I get this one right, his last MMA fight was at PPC Kratos Cup 12 against Evgeny Golub in November of 2020. That one at heavyweight, he gets the win. And Matt, for Askar Mazhirov, I don't care if it's welterweight, middleweight, light heavyweight, or heavyweight, this guy is a flashy f***ing striker, and I am there for it. And I've seen him give up in a fight before, which I don't love, but he's a fun guy to watch. He is.
I've seen a lot of people give up in fights, though, so I'm not going to worry too much. It's going to be really interesting to see how good he looks against a guy like Alonzo Menafield, because this is a huge step up for a guy making his UFC debut. I know Menafield doesn't always look great against the upper tier of the division, but he's still been in there with them, and that's why this fight is going to be so interesting, because for Alonzo Menafield, we know how big he is for this weight division, and I'm glad you bring up just the overall, I don't know, complexity of Askar's, I guess, just past career, because you're right. He's somebody who fought at 170, 185, 205, and heavyweight. But he's weird because he is young in his career, and I somewhat do attribute it to that. When you're 27 years old, you are going to get bigger as you fight, and he has been fighting for a number of years now. I'm not going to say it explains all of the weight gain.
He just does a lot of weightlifting.
We have seen a lot of fighters gain weight throughout their careers and jump up in weight class. I know it's much more of a boxing thing, but it's happened. Alistair Overeem used to be built like me, and then he was not
Diego
built
Sanchez
like me.
Did it.
Diego Sanchez did it, beat Nick Diaz all the way up at middleweight. That's a fun fact that a lot of people should go back. But for Askar, he is such a light on his feet striker that I am kind of surprised to see the progression in his weight classes, or at least just moving up in weight classes, because he fights like a welterweight. And I know we say this sometimes about, I can't believe I'm going blank on this. Middleweight, who's the best heavyweight now?
Jared Cannonier?
No. Middleweight, who is now a heavyweight.
Oh, Jake Collier.
Jake Collier, exactly. Jake Collier physically looks like a heavyweight right now, but he still fights a lot like the guy he used to be at middleweight. Askar's kind of similar to where he is light on his feet, very flashy with his kicks. And the thing I do like about him, he can throw kicks while he's repositioning his feet. Now, against wrestlers, that's not going to be a very good thing, and that might get him caught. But that's a really high-level striking technique that you don't often see because he is so light on his feet and he does have a really nice bounce. I do worry a little bit just about his throwing in combinations because most people want to throw punches to then set up their kicks or use a couple low kicks to then set up their punches. Asgard just kind of explodes into stuff and multiple spinning kicks or body kicks into a row, and that does worry me because if you are just going back to that well over and over and over again, maybe you hit Metafield with the first one, but the second one he might block and the third one he might counter. So I am a little worried about, it might be weird to say the predictability of Asgard, but he is almost predictable with his unpredictability.
He walks in on a straight line, throws crazy stuff, and if it lands, he knocks guys out and finishes them. And it's really weird because, again, his last MMA fight was in November of 2020. He took a fight in 2021. It was a bare-knuckle fight, and I went searching for it. And then it was like a dirty website where it was like slap ass, and oh, we have like regular slap competitions, and oh, by the way, some bare knuckles. So I just found the highlight on Twitter. But realistically, he lands a crazy right hand and then finishes it up. 8-second knockout over Victor Jones, who, and I want to make sure I get this one right for the folks at home, Victor Jones' MMA record, 5-16. Those are the quality of people that go into bare knuckle boxing. Sorry to the bare knuckle fans. But if you do look at it, Asgard was a day's notice replacement fighter. He was supposed to come in and fight Jordan Young with PFL, replacing Vinny Magalhães. He weighed in, they faced off, they like put their fists in each other's face. And then it was like, okay, Asgard's not in the fight. And then the UFC went, okay, I like the way this guy looks, like sign him. Like, it's a really weird signing. He was due to fight last year Ben Rothwell and Dustin Jacoby. Those fights fell out. It says visa issues in one spot, injuries, whatever. But Asgard is finally due to make his UFC debut, replacing Nikolai Negomirianu, who was deemed out of this bout on April 29th. So a little bit of time to get ready for this matchup against Alonzo Menafield. And for Menafield, it should be said, this guy, Dana White's Contender Series guy, he beat Deshaun Boatwright, a name that I'm going to talk about coming up.
It just always felt like Menafield was supposed to be better than he was in the UFC.
Yeah, he finished Vinicius Mojea very quickly. He finished Paul Craig on that spinning back kick that Paul Craig went for, and then he just hammered him, kind of, not the back of the head, but as he was spinning. Loses to Devin Clark, loses to Vince St. Preux, beats Fabio Schrant, beats Ed Herman, and then loses to William Knight in a fight that was very, very close, but very, very boring. So a good opportunity for both of these guys. And for Majerov, win, lose, or draw, this is going to be your favorite fighter's favorite fighter. If you like Johnny Walker, you're going to like Askar Mazarov.
And that would honestly be a really fun fight to put together in the future if he is able to win this one. For Mazarov, though, I do worry about him fighting anybody who has a well-rounded game plan in the top 15. Because once you do get to the top 15, it's less about your strengths and more about the fact that you don't have any apparent weaknesses in your game. And for Mazarov, he's going to have those weaknesses just with his striking style. Now, against Menafield, who can get caught in a mirror sometimes, well, not even sometimes, quite often in his fights, I do think Asgard could go in there, get one of those, just blow the doors off him kind of knockouts, knock him out 20 seconds, and then everybody thinks he is the next big deal. But Alonzo Menafield is steady when he does win his fights, and that's something I always go back to. If Menafield decides, hey, I'm bringing the wrestling shoes, I'm using clinch control, I'm not going to allow this fight to even get started, I really think Menafield's going to set himself up for a really fun win. But this is one of those fights where, if Twitter's showing highlights of it, Alonzo Menafield's probably not the one who won.
Yeah, like Askar Mazarov, world's most interesting man. Complete physical transformation. He was a welterweight from 2014 to 2016, a middleweight from 2020 to 2021, and now all of a sudden, like the middleweight, light heavyweight, heavyweight back to light heavyweight transformation. So it'll be interesting to see what he looks like this weekend. For Menafield, kind of like Hakeem Dawodu, coming out of Saxon's Muay Thai, but also Fortis MMA, get a little bit of the striking, get a little bit of the grappling. He's kind of got a little bit of everything. But again, I talked about the Mazarov fight. His last loss was against Christian Torres, a guy coming out of Sanford MMA. And Torres is like a jack of all trades, taking the fight on short notice. Mazarov should be winning this fight, right? Well, Torres gets it down to the ground, and he lands a steady elbow to Mazarov's forehead. And Mazarov puts his hand up like a kid in class. And the referee's like, what? And then Torres lands two more elbows and Mazarov taps due to strikes. So it was a really weird ending to that one. Again, he has won three fights since then, but they were a long time ago. So we do look at the odds for this fight. Alonzo Menafield, the UFC veteran of many fights, open to minus 130 favorite, minus 161 right now. For Askar Mazarov, open to plus 110, plus 134. We have a look at Tapology. The votes are a surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Mazarov.
I think Menafield will be the favorite.
Menafield's the favorite. Slight favorite. 1,255 total votes. 55% Menafield, 76% by knockout. For the 45% that are Mazarov, 52%, or sorry, that's 82% by knockout. So a strong preponderance of knockouts in the air, Matt, by the fans. What's the pick?
I'm going to do the old Mike Wilbon. If Alonzo Metafield's the guy I think he is, he should be able to win this fight. Again, he has the much higher level of experience throughout his UFC career. And they might not all be wins, but you still learn when you go in there and fight really high level guys. It's like the rub. Stipe always talked about this. Like, Stipe fought JDS and he lost the first time. But guess what? He had a really close fight with one of the best heavyweights of all time. And it made Stipe realize, like, hey, I'm not that far away from it after all. For Metafield, again, I can't believe I just compared him to Stipe Miocic. But I do think with his overall well-rounded game and the ability to wrestle in this matchup, I do like him. Although I can fully admit he could get put on a poster in the first round easily.
Alonzo Metafield, the Eric Silva of this division. He's already 34 years old. I have Metafield in this matchup. I like the steadiness of his shots. He's not as wild. And if he can keep his defenses up, he can win this fight. But Askar Mazarov just has to watch an Ovince St. Preux highlight and realize that he could knock out Alonzo Metafield. So a great fight coming up this weekend. I'm so glad that we finally get to see Askar Mazarov out of Odessa, Ukraine, Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. But he's trained in Florida forever. He is an international man of mystery. And I am here for it. Let us know down below in that comment section who you have. Toss a like and a sub if you haven't already. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, battling it out at flyweight, we have the debuting most aggressive nickname you've ever heard, Killer Karin Silva, taking on Pollyanna Battaglio. Battaglio in the UFC, 3-3, leaving a lot to be desired. But out of Battaglio, a very interesting fighter, because we always consider pre-UFC records, and you look at it for Battaglio, you look at the loss, I mean, yeah. At Viviani Paheia, was it really that great? No, but she also has wins over Silvana Gomez-Juarez, who ended up in the UFC as well.
When she was 38.
As current Invicta FC flyweight champ Karina Rodriguez. So good wins there for Pollyanna Battaglio. But for Battaglio in the UFC, again, a mixed bag. I touched on it, the fact that yes, 3-3. But you look at the wins, Pearl Gonzalez, Siri Kondo, and Lauren Mueller. Not the best of wins.
Very bad.
The loss is Cynthia Calvillo, Jillian Robertson, a split decision loss to Luana Carolina her last time out. That was back in early 2021. She has had fight bookings since, at least one of them against Ji-Yun Kim earlier on this year. That one fell out. Her last fight against Luana Carolina, she beat the brakes off her in the first round. I thought it was a 10-8. Everybody thought it was a 10-8, but the judges, and she ends up losing that fight, second round, third round. She just didn't have gas left in the tank in that one. So Battaglio revamps, rebooks, and now she's taking on Silva. Both of these fighters out of Brazil, and two big Brazilian teams for Battaglio, Novo Nhao. For Karin Silva, out of Gile Ribeiro team, or Ribeiro team, you might know, I don't know, Augusto Sakai, who trains at that gym, but there are multiple different big-time fighters out of that gym. Matt, when it comes down to this matchup, though, both very much adept in the striking. This should be fun while it lasts.
There's a part of me that really hopes Karin Silva turns into Ariane Carnelosi part two. I don't think it's going to happen because Carnelosi does incorporate her grappling a little bit more, but I think there's a world out there where she could become that level of, yep, I hate to say like a money fight because that's ridiculous. It's not really a money fight, but you get what I mean. Just like one of those fights on a card that you get more excited for than you should.
Oh,
because
Karin Silva fight.
Ooh. She throws bricks on the feet, though. And that's the thing about Karin Silva. She puts every ounce of her being into everything she does. And that's probably going to work against someone like Pollyanna, who, if there is a weakness against her, she's not the most physically strong fighter in the division, or really just in the UFC. She is kind of wiry. I don't just mean, listen, so am I. Don't feel bad. But for Pollyanna, I do think she can have success in this fight, but I think there's a part of her that could just get out-muscled in a lot of those key positions throughout this fight, because if Karin Silva just gets her in the clinch, gets two underhooks, and holds her up against the cage, well, Pollyanna doesn't really have body-to-body takedowns or anything. She's not some trip artist. Like, I think she could get out of that position, but that's going to require a ton of energy for Pollyanna to get out of. And it's just a very simple offensive move for Karin Silva basically to stall the fight. And I don't even think she's going to do that. I just think this is probably more than any other fight on the card. This fight's going to play down to physicality. And I do think Karin Silva has a big X factor with her physicality.
Yeah, I mean, Silva's 14-4 with 14 wins by finish. Three of her four losses are also by finish. And if you look at it, Dana White's Contender Series was a way that she's getting her way into the UFC. The Contender Series curse, but her last time out, she took on Kihui Yuan, and in that fight, her opponent was a WLF Wars fighter out of the Shanghai Performance Institute. What are we going to get? Mixed bag is what you usually get. She had a win over Liang Na, which was interesting, who made it into the UFC. But Silva was a minus 290 favorite in that. Had a good first round. Second round, she came out. And if Marc-Andre Barrio is the power bar, Karine Silva is like the Palomine bar. And listen, New Brunswick candy reference, they changed what they do to make the Palomine bars, and now they're gooey and they're not as hard and rigid. So Palomine bar, Karine Silva looked completely gassed in the second round. However, she was able to get that wild finish of her own, and she ends up with a big time guillotine.
Gogo Plata,
she looked amazing. In the first round, she kept threatening Gogo Plata, Alma Plata, which was a lot of fun. But again, it just zapped a lot out of her. Her striking style is very, very demanding. She throws everything into her shots. She is a very good striker in her own right. Again, you don't get 14 finishes out of your 14 wins for nothing. Pollyanna Battaglio, Muay Thai background. That's a lot of fun. Good kicks, too. Good kicks.
But the problem is there's not a lot of snap on the end of them. That's my problem with these people who are Muay Thai fighters or kickboxers who don't have any knockout power on their strikes. Yeah, it's great that you throw in combination, you throw in technique. But damaging strikes are the things that count a lot more than anything else in the world of MMA. It's the number one thing on the scoring criteria. Damage. And I do think Karine Silva is the much more likely to cause damage in this fight, because for Pollyanna, a lot of her success does either come from her own offensive takedowns, which we haven't seen in a hot minute, let's be fair, or it's just her kind of wrapping up her opponents. And I say wrapping up more as a grappling way, but she could wrap them up just by out-voluming them on the feet and forming them, or causing them to get into a defensive shell so that they're not reacting themselves. I still think Karine Silva is going to get into that type of a mode. I think she's going to try to meet fire with fire. It's just going to be interesting. Can Silva survive that third round if the fight does get there? Because like you said, her wins come by finish, but her losses come by finish too. And a lot of those losses do come because she empties her gas tank early and then leaves a massive window for her opponent to then close the distance and win the fight as it goes late. So for Silva, she really is just playing the extremes right now.
Yeah, you look at it for Battaglio when she's winning, when she's doing well, she's incorporating the takedown. Might not be the best game plan against Silva. You look at the odds, Battaglio open to plus 165, underdog plus 101 or thereabouts right now. For Silva, open to minus 190, minus 122. So the odds are closing into par. We have a look at the Topology vote. Surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 65% for the newcomer, Silva.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It is way over. 1,292 total votes, 81% Silva, 63% by submission for the 19% that of Battaglio, 76% by decision. So listen, Silva's only been beaten once by decision, but she has gotten finished. She does tire. Battaglio went balls to the wall in the first round of her last fight. Enough to get a 10-8, who knows, but she was tired as that one went on. She's been off for a while too. That fight against Luana Carolina, if you go back, that was about a year ago, the split decision loss. Matt, what is the pick in this fight?
I'm going to pick Karine Silva. She is slightly younger. She has been more active as of late, and I do think those things really do matter. If Pollyanna does decide to try to meet fire with fire like she did in her last fight, come out really strong, I think she's going to play right into Karine Silva's hand, and I do think it's going to help Silva as this fight goes on, because let's say they do get into like a John Lineker or Francisco Rivera type of a fight, Karine Silva's probably going to end up winning that type of matchup.
Francisco Rivera, an all-time great, having a lot of fun. But Matt, when I do look at this fight, as good as Karine Silva is, and she is a killer out there, that is the nickname, I like Pollyanna Battaglio to win a decision in this one. I know it's not the sexiest pick to have out there, but I will go with Battaglio to at least keep an output as the fight goes on. I really don't like what I saw out of Silva. Again, she looked great on the mat. She looked great with the power. But when she starts to throw power, she does start to tire. I like Battaglio to be the fresher of the two. But would I be surprised if the favorite here, Silva, wins? No, not necessarily. So we're both split on the pick in this one. I'm going with Pollyanna Battaglio. You have Karine Silva to get the win. We're going to need to know. We got to know with the tiebreaker, the fans. You got to let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Three big-time fights left. Lucas Almeida making the UFC debut, taking on Mike Trezano. Co-main event, Dan Ige taking on Movsar Evloev. And in the main event, ooh boy, Alexander Volkov and Jairzinho Rozenstruik. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, we have the former Ultimate Fighter winner, Mike Trezano, taking on the former Jungle Fights lightweight champ, Lucas Almeida. This one at 145 pounds. And for Mike Trezano, it's been a mixed bag. I mean, I expected a lot when he came into the UFC. He could mix in his wrestling, but primarily known for his boxing. And in some of his fights, I mean, pick. Even his last win over Ludovic Klein, he really did bring everything together. His fight against Luis Pena, his fight against Joe Giannetti. You look at the losses, I mean, he loses to Grant Dawson, somewhat forgivable. I mean, a big-time prospect at 155. And his last fight against Hakeem Dawodu, where it was fire versus fire, and obviously Dawodu was able to win out in that one. But for Mike Trezano, so far in the UFC, is he maybe one of the more forgettable or least talked about Ultimate Fighter winners of recent memory?
I can't name you another Ultimate Fighter winner from recent memory. They do a terrible job promoting the winners of this show.
But it's going on right now. You're not watching?
No, oh, not at all. Because here's the problem. Tuesday Night Contenders gives me the best part of the Ultimate Fighter. I just don't have to put up with an hour of BS in between.
So Lucas Almeida was on Tuesday Night Contender Series last year. He took on a big-time prospect. They pumped the kid's tires. His name is Daniel Zellhuber. And in that fight, Zellhuber gets the win. It was a fun fight.
It was a really good one.
First round was an absolute banger. Second round, Zellhuber takes over. He also wins the third round. But after the fights, Dana White, and I'll paraphrase, but he said, listen, Daniel, you look great. But this Lucas Almeida guy, he fought his heart out. He gets a win on a regional promotion. I'll definitely look to sign him back. And that's exactly what Almeida did. He went out and took on Italo Trindade. And in that fight, he looked to be about three weight classes bigger than Trindade.
He's
and
huge.
I got to be specific here. Almeida is a lightweight. I don't know how he's going to look at featherweight. He does look like he can lose a little bit around the middle. But that's about it. And that's just my approximation. But Trindade, I thought, well, this guy looks blown up. And then you go to his fight before he fought Almeida. It was a catchweight of 165. And it's like, okay, well, that's super lightweight. And then it went down through his whole record. The super lightweight fight was a one-off. The lightweight fight was a one-off. The guy was a featherweight. And in that fight, Almeida looked so, so much bigger. But Matt, I go through and I look at the way that Almeida fights. And he fights kind of like regional scene Chaos Williams. He stands there, plants and throws. He goes absolutely balls to the wall. And of his 13 wins, all 13 by finish. Who the hell knows what he's going to look like in the UFC, but it's kind of fun to watch in the regional scene.
And against a guy like Mike Trezano, who, you're right, you say how forgettable he is as an Ultimate Fighter, or as the Ultimate Fighter winner. But the thing about Trezano, he's well-rounded, but again, in one of those kind of awkward ways to where it's like, hey, if you just took a little bit more away from your wrestling, put it into your boxing, then we'd look at you as sort of a primary boxer who could really hurt people with his hands. It just feels like every time you feel confident with his boxing, then his wrestling lets you down. Every time you feel confident in his wrestling, his boxing lets you down. Just for Trezano, it's a matter of bringing it all together. And I'm sure people are tired of us saying that about 90% of the UFC roster, but it's the truth. Trezano has good cardio. He has decent striking defense. He's not someone who gets hit clean all that often. Hakeem Dawodu was able to, but he throws in combination. He's a very high level striker, so that's going to happen. It's for Trezano, nothing he does is over that like 6 out of 10, and that's the only problem for him. And that's why this fight against Almeida should be so interesting, because if Almeida can keep it on the feet and just try to throw power shots early, he should have a great chance to win this fight, because Trezano's someone who, he does like using his boxing. He will hold his hands very high. His head movement is weird, though, because he'll just kind of move his head. There's not really rhyme or reason to it. Sometimes he'll move into a shot, sometimes he'll move with a shot. It just kind of depends on where the shot's coming from and when he does decide to incorporate his movement. It's sort of luck-based, though. I know, like, in baseball, there's, what, FIP, where it's like if you hit it in the air, it doesn't take into consideration what the fielders are going to do. For Mike Trezano, there needs to be, like, a UFC equivalent of a stat like that. I just think for him, he's so well-rounded, it's almost become a crutch for him, because no matter what he's doing, he's never overly confident in it, and he's always trying to change the range of the fight. I always go back to the Luis Pena matchup, where he looked really good in that fight, but it was, you're looking really good in some parts, but the places you're not looking good in, you're looking very poor in, and that's what I worry about. When Trezano does fight a long-range striker, he always does seem to struggle with those kinds of guys, because he doesn't have much kick-wise of his own offense, and his takedowns are good, but I wouldn't say his entries are great just yet. I think that's something he does have to work on.
Well, there's a lot of stories on this card. Rinat Fakhretdinov, he's taking on Andreas Mikhailidis. Do they fight at welterweight? Never, but they are this weekend. You have so many different fighters moving around with weight classes. Lucas Almeida on the deep dive, he has experience at welterweight as well as at lightweight. He also walked out in his last fight to, you know, the song from Big Daddy, Sweet Child of Mine. And then he gets the win and they play more Guns N' Roses. So he is very much a 1990s, like, let's get into it type of guy. Like, cracking a Budweiser on the tailgate of a Silverado down in Brazil. So for Lucas Almeida, he has a Muay Thai background. He has a kickboxing background. He has awful takedown defense. He has some submissions. But man, like, I've seen really low-level guys. Like, I went back and watched this fight against, and I want to make sure that I get this one right, because it was a fight coming into Dana White's Contender Series, and he had about a two-year layoff. He fought Nico Kakushio, and in that fight, Kakushio was 9-2-1. It was the saltiest 9-2-1 I've ever seen. Again, looked two weight classes smaller. He just walks across the cage with his hands out for a double leg takedown, and he gets it on Almeida, and Almeida then has to work his way back up from the center of the cage. Like, Lucas Almeida, wild with his hands, fiery, knocks guys out, and it's a lot of fun to watch, but I have no idea what his ceiling is in the UFC.
I can say the exact same thing about Mike Trezano, though.
Yeah, I don't know. So I look at the odds in this one. Mike Trezano opened minus 180, minus 238 right now. Almeida opened a plus 155, plus 191 right now. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 80% Trezano.
I'll say slightly under.
You saw these beforehand. I did not. 1,255 total votes. 78% Trezano. 87% by decision. 22% that I have Almeida. 43% by decision. 27% by submission. 21% by knockout. I think Mike Trezano wins this fight. I think he wins a decision. I think it might not be the most entertaining fight you've ever seen. Again, Dana White's Contender Series curse, whatever it is, but you look at the last guy that just straight up got a contract off a loss in a close fight, Carlos Candelario. He was brought in to lose here not that long ago. Lucas Almeida, out of the regional scene fights that I've seen, the knockouts are great. The level of competition is not great at all. I don't think he's a very impressive fighter.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
That's the
Mike Trezano isn't either. Like, I have Mike Trezano, but Mike Trezano's done nothing in the UFC to make me confident in picking him in this fight. I like his wrestling, and I do think he can use his wrestling, and that's why I'm going to pick him in this. But, like, I think you're almost discrediting Almeida a little too much to prop Trezano up. I really don't think Mike Trezano's the type of guy who could win this fight and then go on to win five or six other ones afterwards. Like, this really is do or die for both guys, even though it's young in their careers. I have Trezano, but again, I'm relying on a guy to use basically just his wrestling in this matchup, and he will play the striking game before he goes for a takedown, so it is going to be a dangerous
one. I will say, Almeida does have nice front chokes, kind of like we saw Simon Oliveira coming or came into the UFC, similar idea in that last fight that Mr. Almeida did have over Jungle Fights to keep that belt, because he had like a long hiatus, but then he's back into a title fight. He was able to sync up the choke, pull into his guard, and then get the submission. So we'll see how that plays out against Trezano, but both of us going with the lone wolf, Mike Trezano, to get the win. Let us know if you have the former Jungle Fights champ Almeida, or if you're going with Trezano in this one. Big time co-main event and main event left on this card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend at Featherweight, this is one of those fights that I can get up for. We have 50K Dan Ige taking on Movsar Evloev, the former champ with M1 Global, and an interesting fighter at that. He's 15-0 as a pro. He has many, many wins that you might recognize, but the real knock against Movsar Evloev is the fact that we don't get to see him often enough. I mean, you look at UFC wins, Sungwoo Choi, Enrique Barzola, who's just doing the damn thing over with Bellator, Mike Grundy, Nick Lentz by split decision, then his last time out almost a year ago, a big win over Hakeem Dawoodu, where he just ground out the great striker. For Movsar Evloev, obviously, we've seen some evolution in his game. We've seen him mix in some little different wrinkles. But you know him for his bread and butter. It is his takedowns. For 50K Dan Ige, great in scrambles. And a really, really speedy fighter. You look at Ige, his biggest win, the win over Edson Barboza, is very controversial in a main event. He then goes on to lose to Calvin Kattar, but then he brings it right back against Gavin Tucker and looks amazing in that fight, finishes him. Now, he has lost to the Korean Zombie and Josh Emmett in his last two. The fight against Emmett, it wasn't that bad.
He got hit with some big shots.
It was pretty bad. And the fight that he had against the Korean Zombie, Zombie worked in his grappling in that one, which was a little bit of a surprise, too.
And that's the great thing about Dan Ige. Even when he does lose, you're never looking at that fight being like, oh, he had no success. Or, does he really belong in this
later fight?
But he was able to be competitive for 25 minutes in a primary boxing fight with another boxer. Like, he didn't get knocked out in the first minute. So, this is the weird fight, though. If you look at the odds in this fight, and I know we normally get to it a little bit later, Movsar Evloev is a very big favorite here, if you want to read them.
So he opened a minus 200, minus 405 right now. Dan Ige opened plus 170, plus 304.
So we get fights like this every now and then, where you have someone who's kind of on the outskirts of the rankings, or in that 14 to 15 range, and they're finally getting their big opportunity, and they're going to fight like that top 5 fighter, but also they're going to be a huge favorite going into that fight. Doesn't happen often, but I always remember when Khabib fought Michael Johnson, that was kind of his first introduction to the limelight. Michael Johnson was in the top 5. He was a big favorite going into that. Another one, a more recent example, Khamzat Chimaev versus Gilbert Burns. Like, there is sort of precedence for this in the past, but this is kind of where my question leads to. What has Movsar Evloev done to be justified as such a big favorite over Dan Ige? And I know some people look at Dan Ige and they agree with what you said. He had a close fight with Edson Barboza. A lot of people felt like he lost that fight. He hasn't been able to beat any of the top contenders, even though he has been in there with them. And his biggest win as of late is over Gavin Tucker, who, you know, we like. But let's be honest, Gavin Tucker's not really at the level of some of these other guys. I'm just curious why so many people are confident in Movsar Evloev, a guy who I witnessed with my own two eyes get caught in multiple guillotines by Nick Lentz. And they kind of got really scary at a couple points, too. Like, I know Evloev is largely, and I don't like saying it this way, I just don't know how to say it, he's kind of credited with ending the career of Nick Lentz. He was able to damage him a lot in that fight, and I know it's a split decision. I'm here to tell you it wasn't. Movsar Evloev beat the brakes off Nick Lentz. It's just Lentz was credited with some of those close guillotine attempts, and that's what the judges saw. But Evloev did make at least a little bit of an evolution with his own striking in that fight, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how much does he strike with a guy like Dan Ige, because Ige is at his most dangerous in that boxing range, but like you said, great with the scrambles, got really good takedown defense himself. I'm just curious, when do you think Evloev goes for a takedown? Is it the first exchange? Do you think he plays around on the feet a little bit? How do you see the early goings of this fight?
Yeah, to me, Evloev's one of those weird cats where we've seen him train at Tiger Muay Thai in the past, kind of like a Pyotr Jan, and then making the evolution in the UFC, and what do we get? Well, with Pyotr, his ground game's not... I mean, his last time out, it was great.
Pretty good.
He got backpacked, but usually... it's not too bad. Movsar is striking. It's not great. It's not bad.
Improving.
It's not great, but it is the relentless takedown attempts. It is the pressure. It is the threat of the submission at all times. And again, for Evloev in the UFC, consider this. Sung Woo Choi, decision win. Enrique Barzol, decision win. Mike Grundy, decision win. Nick Lentz, decision win. And it's weird, too, because for a guy who's a grappler, they gave him all good grapple. I mean, Sung Woo Choi is what it is. I mean, Sting's good at the feet. He's got some submissions, but that is usually where he lacks. But the other guys, Grundy, good wrestler. Again, in the UFC, it wasn't a great run. Enrique Barzola, like I said, doing it over with Bellator. He's inserted himself into that Grand Prix. And Nick Lentz, I mean, the carny, he's the guillotine king.
Yes.
Hakeem Dawodu, though, I mean, for Movsar Evloev, what you saw in that fight was, and Matt, I know you talk about it a lot. Okay, both guys are good at striking. One guy might have a slight advantage on the ground. Who's going to break first and go for a takedown? I don't look at it like that in this fight as, okay, well, Movsar can't hang with Dan Ige, so he's got to go for the takedown. I think it's Movsar's so good on the ground, he should take Dan Ige down. He's probably going to take Dan Ige.
I'm just curious if he does have that kind of a game plan, and if Ige is able to defend some of those takedowns early. I know what Dan Ige looks like in the fifth round of a grueling fight, and he looks pretty much like the fighter who showed up in the first round, other than some of the damage he eats. But that's the other thing you have to talk about with Dan Ige. One of the toughest guys to ever fight in this division.
So Dan Ige has 5 more fights than Movsar Evloev. Look at their faces. One guy's been hit a lot more.
But that's the thing about Ige. Like, he ate overhand rights from Josh Emmett. I don't think you understand how crazy of a statement that is. Like, he ate some of the biggest punches this division has to offer his last time out, and that was a pretty close fight he had with Emmett. Emmett definitely won it, but Dan Ige made a fairly good account of himself in some of those boxing exchanges, and that's why I'm curious to see if this fight does make it to the third round. If Ige is able to defend some of those takedown attempts early, I definitely think Ige can outstrike Evloev in the first round, but if Evloev's a more tired version of himself, if his hands start to drop and drop and drop, that's when Dan Ige could set up a big shot later on in this fight. I just think this is such a fun fight because Evloev has that eye-catching talent. There's just a few questions we'd love to see get answered, and Dan Ige is the type of opponent who will answer those questions for us.
So we threw it on out to you in the YouTube community tab in saying that, hey, we got to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this one? Bo said, seeing how successful TKZ was against Ige in the grappling department makes me side with Evloev, but I'm definitely not betting on it. Bill saying, I like Evloev because of the ground game. He knows when to mix it in, secure rounds if he can't find a finish. Also, I didn't like Dan Ige's recent performance in he's 2-3 in his last five fights. What else? Dan Farmer, Evloev easily in the grappling. John saying Evloev probably wrestles him for two rounds and barely escapes last round. It's a draw. JB saying Evloev by a mile, and I'll go with one more. Dev the Dude saying easy one. And I heard him MMA analysis, who's always there in the comment section, saying Evloev. So Matt, fans are with Evloev. He's -400 favorite. Pop popcorn.
So, I don't like the odds.
What is the pick here? Because I do have Mavzar Evloev. I think he can mix it in. Again, Korean Zombie for Dan Ige, you're probably thinking I have a grappling advantage here. So if we strike, it is what it is. And then Korean Zombie's taking me down. What's going on? Like that.
Korean
one
Zombie
is,
did Darce choke Dustin Poirier, though. Like, Korean Zombie can grapple his ass off.
Remember that? Twister.
Because Leonard Garcia, guy who could not grapple. Here's the weird thing about this fight. I'll say this, how like Teddy Atlas gives his predictions in his podcast. For the odds, I don't think Dan Ige is a bad pick. I'm just going to say that right now. He's fought the way higher level of competition. It's not even close. Whether he's beat them or not, I do not care. He has been in there with some of the best guys in the world, and I really do think that matters. I agree with you, though. I do think if Mavzar is able to get that takedown early, there's not much Dan Ige is going to be able to do defensively off his back. I think maybe he can avoid getting submitted like a lot of Mavzar's past opponents have been able to, but I do see Mavzar being able to go back to the takedown over and over again. Ige might be able to make it more competitive in that third round, but I do like Mavzar Evloev in this fight. I'll say this, though. I'm way more excited for this than the main event.
Oh, yeah.
Not even close.
Oh, yeah. Big time featherweight action coming up this weekend. Both of us going with the man who does not possess a nickname, but is a former M1 Global Champion, Mavzar Evloev, to get the win. Let us know again down in that comment section. Hit it up, and if you haven't subscribed already, do that. Please, because it would mean a lot to the channel, a like as well, but we don't ask for much. We got a big-time main event coming up. You shouldn't sleep on it. Volkov taking on Rozenstrike. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. In an interesting main event coming up this weekend, we have Drago, Alexander Volkov, in another main event, taking on Biggie Boy Jairzinho Rozenstrike in another main event. And for both of these guys, sketchy results as of late. I mean, for Rozenstrike, comes into the UFC and he's off like a freight train. He's looking amazing. He's like Anthony Hamilton way back when. Or for those of you who don't know Anthony Hamilton, like Alan Jackson at one point, I guess.
Which was a decent locomotive. What a good song.
Good tune. But for Rozenstrike in the 5-on-in, a loss to Francis Ngannou, a win over JDS, a loss to Cyril Gane, a win over Augusto Sakai, and a loss his last time out to Razor Blades. And for Volkov, went over Walt Harris, went over Overeem, lost to Cyril Gane, went over Tybura, and then a loss to Tom Aspinall. And I mention this because, yes, Rozenstrike, 2-3 in his last five. Volkov, 3-2 in his last five. But these two guys in their last five fights have shown like night and day differences for better or for worse. And even in some of those wins, they've shown some bad spots.
For Rozenstrike, it's so strange because every time he has success at the UFC level, it's him moving forward, throwing in combination. And I can give you many examples. Junior Albini, his first UFC victim, he gets taken down over and over again. The first round has no success whatsoever. And then the second round starts, blitzes forward, hits him with a head kick, fights over. Everybody's excited about our boy, Biggie Boy. Next time out, Alan Crowder knocks him out the first punch he throws. Andre Arlovski knocks him out the first punch he throws. Alistair Overeem has no success whatsoever, but what's the common theme of Jairzinho's career? What happened with 10 seconds left? Decided to move forward and throw in combination. One of those punches lands, Alistair goes down. It's just when you watch Rozenstrike, he's one of the more frustrating fighters to watch because it is so apparent what his strengths are and how he could most easily employ them. I have to go back to the Augusto Sakai fight. I've had a lot of people ask me, what do you think about the height difference between Alexander Volkov and Jairzinho, and do you think it's going to play a factor? I honestly don't, and this is why. Augusto Sakai physically is kind of similar to Alexander Volkov. They're not that separate height-wise. I think Sakai comes in at 6'5", Volkov 6'7", but they are very, very close.
Rozenstrike is the shortest 6'2 you've ever seen. The guy's 6 feet tall.
Exactly. But the way Rozenstrike does throw punches is in this very exaggerated looping fashion, and it does help him hit those taller guys at this weight class. So although Volkov's height normally is a big strength for him, I do think just the style of Rozenstrike is going to help him get past that, because on the outside, he's going to have no success anyways because of how big Volkov is, and Jairzinho's whole game plan is to get on the inside. So I actually think this is one of those kind of double-edged sword reaches of Volkov. Volkov to where, yeah, it's going to help him early on in this fight, but if Rozenstruik can do what Tom Aspinall did, just get on the inside of him, Volkov has not shown the ability to fight guys off of him, to really use his mobility, because he's just very big, but he doesn't use his frame all that well. It's like he's set in his positions. It's not like he's learning as the fight goes on.
Yeah, and it's kind of crazy. I know the UFC put the video out there of Volkov finishing Fabricio Werdum. That's their big push for this weekend. They could have gone with any other fight.
I like the Overeem one.
They could have gone with the Wilder Harris one, too. I do like the Overeem one as well. But it's weird to see the peaks and valleys of Volkov's career, because not that long ago, Bellator 2015, losing to Tony Johnson.
That was 7 years ago,
losing
Craig.
Losing to Czech Congo, but that was off a big win streak. Then he goes on another win streak, ends up in the UFC, beats Stroop, beats Werdum, and it's like, wow, we're off to the races. He's beating Derek Lewis until the final bell. And then Derek Lewis beats him. He beats Greg Hardy. And then he loses to Curtis Blaydes. He gets taken down a bunch. And then he beats Wilder Harris and Overeem. And the reason why I talk about those two wins, because that looked like another new Volkov. He was thick boy Volkov. He gained weight. He looked big. He was confident. He had a new back piece. Everything was different. And then he fought Ciryl Gane. And Gane was able to take some of those big punches. He was able to get in those in-between positions and beat Volkov in the spots where he gets uncomfortable. Then Volkov goes out and fights Marcin Tybor. And numbers on a page, you might go, hey, that's a good win for Volkov. No, it wasn't.
Very hesitant performance from him.
It wasn't the best Volkov we've ever seen. It's a W on a record, but it's not a big Volkov win.
Volkov's very odd because he likes to go for those kind of like a check knee up the middle. It's something Cowboy Cerrone used a lot in the early parts of his career. But it got Volkov caught against Derek Lewis. That's what he was going for as Lewis threw that overhead, which made him a lot more easier to get hit from Derek Lewis. It's just a strange almost glitch in his kind of programming, if you will, that he hasn't been able to fix because he still goes for those knees at the middle, and Tybora was able to throw some looping shots and hit him. The difference is Marcin Tybora does not have the punching power of a guy like Jairzinho Rozenstruik or someone even like Tom Aspinall. So I'm very curious to see, is Volkov going to be able to find a way to deal with guys when they do get on the inside? Because wrestling used to be the thing that gave him issues. It was guys would get on the inside, take him down, Volkov couldn't do anything. He was able to gain weight, and that did seem to help him defend some of those takedowns, but the problem was it's almost like he focused so much on defending the takedowns that he never really came up for a solution to deal with strikers to get on the inside of him. And I do think that's going to be what Jairzinho's game plan is.
Yeah, I mean, for Rozenstruik, again, you look at the losses. I mean, Derek Lewis, on Volkov. That Derek Lewis fight, a lot of people remember that, and then they go, okay, Rozenstruik beat Overeem at the 11th hour, so hey, that's how it's gonna happen. But for Rozenstruik in the UFC, again, Francis Ngannou throws windmills at him, knocks him out. Ciryl Gane grinds him up against the cage.
That was an awful fight.
It wasn't a great fight. And Curtis Blaydes was the last matchup.
Can I be honest, though? I didn't think Jairzinho looked that bad against Curtis Blaydes. Like, he almost knocked him out with a flying knee in the third round of that fight. Like, he at least showed that he's still dangerous in the third round of a fight that he's not winning. And yes, that doesn't count for a win. It's a moral victory at that. But it at least proves that Jairzinho still can be dangerous, no matter what the outcome of the fight is. Like, if the Alistair Overeem fight didn't prove that to you, I do feel like the Curtis Blaydes fight helped reinforce that a little bit. Because, yes, it's a loss, but Jairzinho did a pretty good job at defending the takedowns of Curtis Blaydes. It's not like he spent the majority of the fight on his back. The fight was just sort of boring and them looking at each other in the mirror. So I think the best version of Jairzinho, who's moving forward, throwing in combination, could probably knock out Alexander Volkov in like the first, maybe even the second round. It's just, like you said, both of these guys are kind of those peaks and valley type of fighters. So it really depends what version of both guys we're going to get this weekend.
And Tom Aspinall's a great fighter. Extenuating circumstances about Volkov getting to that fight aside, like, Volkov looked really flat in that fight. Straight up, as soon as it started, he looked like a shell of man. So threw this out there in the YouTube community tab. With the dust settled, now we can get to some more exciting stuff. The graphics are updated, of course. You've seen that throughout the tenure of this video, but you folks voted for it. We're going for a different look. And actually, if nobody noticed, the whole thing's different. Everything about this is different. But we threw it on over there to get an idea of what you folks are thinking. Bill is saying, I see this one being a lot like Lewis Volkov, where Volkov is winning until he isn't. Acai Fueled saying either Jairzinho by knockout or Volkov by decision. Jairzinho scorecards equal no action. We also have Carnage, not sure. Really, both have looked very underwhelming recently. I say Volkov due to his reach and volume. I feel like I should be more excited for the fight than I am. Bundle of Humble, I think Volkov, his best days are behind him. Rozenstruik made some improvements and is still hungry. And Chad, the UFC dad, saying, just going to keep on riding these underdogs. Jairzinho all the way. Matt, the odds for this fight, to give you an idea, Volkov minus 160 at open, minus 155 now. Rozenstruik open plus 140, plus 130 or thereabouts. Your thoughts on the pick for this fight?
I like the underdog, Jairzinho Rozenstruik. Again, I took a lot from the Marcin Tybura fight against Alexander Volkov because Tybura went into that fighting like a striker, not fighting like a wrestler like he normally does. And he was able to have fairly good levels of success. He was able to get on the inside of Volkov's reach. And maybe Volkov fought that fight thinking, hey, I can let him get on the inside because he's not as dangerous. I just think that if Rozenstruik is able to crash that distance and even hit him with one big shot over the top, I think Rozenstruik has that kind of power to where he could put Volkov out.
I agree. And Volkov's one of those guys. I agree with your assessment. Volkov's one of those guys. We're throwing a knee. We're going to put a hand up there. There's so much room to get. Like we talk about Justin Gaethje. Just walking forward, hands up here. You either land on his cheeks or you hit his forearms, and that's what you get. But Volkov's defenses are weird. Like, if he was a boxer, like, would he go mummy stance?
Like, Philly Shell is good. Floyd Mayweather fought his whole life doing this. And, like, Dustin Poirier does it, too. You'll see him do that a lot. Those are two extremely good boxers, though. I don't know if you know this. And Volkov, you're right. It's almost like he has that lean back problem. Because, again, I'm going to hammer this home until someone corrects me and tells me I'm wrong. I think tall people, just in general, do something wrong in sparring by being tall. I think when you're used to being the taller person in the training room, you can get used to just being lazy, leaning back. Luke Rockhold had a whole career of doing this. And I do think Volkov does kind of play into my theory a little bit. And that's why I think Rozenstruik can chin him.
And I can't wait to see how the weight cut goes for Paulo Costa in training for that fight with Paddy Pimblett to learn how to make 185. That does excite me quite a bit. I do have Alexander Volkov in this fight for the well-rounded attributes. But again, if Volkov just pushes the pace, which I've seen him do in, what, 34 fights? Like,
it's been a while,
wins.
Though, the problem.
I know it has the last two. And the weirdest part about it is just those last two fights for Volkov. Tybura, not a great win. Is he going to wrestle me? But he does, and he strikes. So it was really weird. And his last time out against Tom Aspinall, you're going into his, you know, home turf in England. Is he going to strike? Is he going to try and grapple me? And Volkov, like, it was just that riff from, you know,
you really like this.
And it's just Rolling Stones, start me up. And he never started up. So I do expect him to come out another big opportunity at a main event to push a pace, to fight a Drago fight, to get a win. But if you like that underdog spot in Jairzinho Rozenstruik, like I said, I agree with your assessment of that.
It's just for Volkov. He hasn't been the thing that he was for a little while now. So I do find it hard to think that he's going to go back in time to find the form that he did find when he fought guys like Fabricio Verdum or even Alistair Overeem when they had fought. I do think maybe past the hills a little bit too aggressive. I just do think he's on the other side of his prime at this point, and that's why I like Rozenstruik.
Matt going with Suriname's own Jairzinho Rozenstruik. I have Alexander Volkov. We have question mark kicks. It's 2 hours before the prelims here on the channel. We switched up the graphics for this show. Question mark kicks will remain unchanged, so you don't have to worry about that. But we're having a lot of fun. I mean, we're trying to get out there. YouTube community tab, Twitter at Fight Night Picks. You can find us there as well on Instagram. Matt, I had a cold all weekend. I was in bed. I was sick. I came out Wednesday night. I took some cold medication. I'm amped. I'm here. I'm sure people will get on me for the way my voice sounds. But hopefully they enjoyed the show. I poured my heart and soul into this one.
14 fun fights on this card. It should be a good one. Like you had said, we have, what, 5 fighters making their UFC debut? 4 ranked fighters. So, should be a really fun card. Hopefully you guys check in 2 question mark kicks 2 hours before the card starts. And have a great week, guys.
So, thanks so much for tuning in. It really does mean a lot. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.